Behold!
An episode of the Gaming Memories Podcast, where I, the prophets, the one true anointed speaker for the gaming gods themselves, even Miyamoto, the Father, Kojima, the Son, and Carmack, the Holy Ghost, has been commissioned to create the one true gaming podcast simply by interviewing creative and interesting people about their favorite gaming memories growing up. And like most prophets, that's not what I'm doing today because, well, sometimes we're a little bit hypocritical. Recently, not recently, because I'm recording this intro much later after the fact, as you can see, I have long hair and I'm in a different room. If you're watching on YouTube, when you get to the actual episode, I'm going to look a lot different because this episode is like a year old, but that's okay because it's timeless. I went through last year and I replaced Final Fantasy 7, 8, 9, 10, and 12. And in this episode, I talk with Chris from the wonderful Retro Hangover podcast about Final Fantasy 7, 8, and 9 because he is my favorite JRPG head to talk shit. And that's it. We talk about Final Fantasy 7, 8, and 9, argue, disagree, talk shit on each other. We had a fantastic time. Him and I are actually working on a separate under the hood JRPG themed podcast, which we will be announcing probably sometime this year and releasing this year. So this gives you a little preview of what maybe our next project might be like, because we love JRPGs. Other than that, you can check out Chris at Retro Hangover Podcast and his fantastic co-host Shane. I will put those applicable links in the podcast description if you feel so inspired. As far as what's going on with the Gaming Memories Pod, I am continuing to tweak emulators and try to get as many podcast episodes out as possible. I do have a soft launch of a Patreon and a Discord. I am not pushing it on social media because I'm still evolving it and trying to make it perfect. But if you're listening to this, you're probably one of the old school fans. And if you would like to throw your money away and burn it and basically wipe your ass with it, you might as well give it to me. It's not worth it, but I'll take it. And you get a little extra things on the side. You get to join the private Discord, which is pretty much a ghost town right now. Just a handful of me and my buddies, but I'm trying to grow it and make it an awesome place to talk about retro, indie, ROM hacks, texture packs, all things sort of on the outskirts of gaming. That's what I'm into. I don't really want to compete with people who cover mainstream stuff because there's so many people who do an incredibly good job of that already, and I don't feel I have anything worthwhile to add. But what I can add is I spend a ridiculously unjustifiable amount of time playing with emulators and digging deep and finding weird stuff on the internet that people don't seem to talk about. So that's my value offer. You can hop into the Discord. You can request games to be covered on social media quicker. If you're part of the Discord, you can bump them up on the request list. There's some other various perks, or you can just simply donate and throw your money away and request a game that way. Either way, full disclosure, none of this is worth your money, and you should be smart with it, and you should take it and you should invest it in something because it's hard-earned money that you worked for. But if you're dumb and a degenerate, as am I, you might as well throw it to me, and that's going to help me scale the podcast, put more content out, pay for editors, and slowly build a much better online product to give you more gaming enjoyment. Other than that, remember to spread the good news of the gaming gospel, and the gods will bless you. I say these things in the name of Miyamoto, the Father, Kojima, the Son, and Carmack, the Holy Ghost. Amen, and enjoy the show.
Christopher the Contrarian. Welcome back.
That's me.
Welcome back.
Happy to be back, man.
I know.
You know what? You always called me the contrarian, and I always told you to go eat shit, go fuck yourself whenever you say that. I probably shouldn't say that because it's within the first 15 seconds, and I know YouTube demonetizes, so I'm sorry if
Wait,
that's...
Wait, does YouTube demonetize with language?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, they do.
Just that one video, right? Not, like, your channel.
Yeah, just that one video. If you say, like, curse words in the first 15 seconds, which I guess I ruined. So you might have to beat that out. Enjoy it.
Whatever. Who cares?
But like, I used to think, like, go fuck yourself, eat and die when you called me the contrarian, like in a joking manner. But now I like look at the games I hate and some of the things I've said about certain series on our show. I'm like, you know what? Kate's right. I am a contrarian.
With certain franchises and IPs where, you know, they're generally well regarded. We're talking about Final Fantasy 7, 8, 9 today. You should know that because the intro will be recorded after this. But one of the first times I talked to Chris, I think even just off record, we weren't recording anything when we were getting to know each other and talking about our JRPG opinions. We were both like, yeah, when someone says, you know, my favorite JRPG is 7, it's hard not to roll your eyes and think that they're a casual JRPG fan.
Absolutely.
But since then, I've heard you really rally off on 7, which is interesting. They can go right into this. I recently replayed all three, the 7, 8, yeah. 9 on the PS1. 7 used to be my least favorite. I used to say it's 8, 9, and 7 in that order.
Yeah.
7 is now my favorite of the three after replaying it.
Okay.
So let's just go in order. Let's talk about 7 first. You recently played it too, right? Maybe not as recent as me, but you played the original version on a PS1, correct?
Yeah, I played it on a PS2, but I mean, same.
Okay, same thing. For those listening, I played the PC version with every mod I could possibly find. So there's a caveat to this. I played with non-chibi characters in the field scenes, with way better models in the field scenes, way better models and textures in the battle scenes. The backgrounds, there's a project called Project Edge, where they don't just upscale the backgrounds using AI. They went through and rebuilt all the backgrounds in Blender in actual 3D and then took a snapshot of them and swapped out the backgrounds. So the version of 7 I played aesthetically is way better than the original version, and it has 60 FPS mod, which is genius. They did something this for 7 and 9, the modders do something called they split the logic up. You have your TPS and your FPS. A lot of these old games, the logic is tied to FPS. So if you run the game at 60 frames a second, the game will speed up. Collision detection will break. You can't climb ladders. Lots of things will break. They split up the gaming's timing, which they made a metric called TPS. They left that the same, but then you can adjust the FPS without impacting the TPS or the logic. So the version of 7 I played is like heavily modded. I don't think that's going to change what we talk about, what makes 7 good or bad, because 99% of that is just aesthetics. And we were talking before the recording started. When I was younger, art direction mattered to me more than it does now. It still matters, but less so as much. But just to be totally honest, the version of 7 I recently played is modded. It has some hacks that fix some translation issues, some restored content. So it's not quite the original. That being said, I really, really enjoyed it way more playing it now as a almost 40-year-old adult than I remembered enjoying it. Obviously, the first time I played it, it was mind-blowing. I think it was mind-blowing for everyone when we played it as kids. But over time, a lot of JRPG heads have almost had this weird love-hate relationship with 7. And I remember you talking about it because you were way into JRPGs and all your friends weren't into them. And then 7 came out and all of a sudden you had all these friends, right, that were into JRPGs. And that sort of started you on the path of having a negative reaction to 7. Is that correct?
I didn't necessarily hate 7. It's just that essentially what you just described. It's that when you're in this little niche circle of whatever you do, I don't think it's just part of gaming or RPGs or whatever the hell, you know, when you feel like you're part of an exclusive group that, you know, people kind of ridicule you for being part of, and all of a sudden something comes out that should be part of your group, and all of a sudden people are adopting that, like you go from this feeling that you're on the outside to now, like, technically you should be on the inside, and you're like, okay, everyone's part of this group all of a sudden, and I'm going to introduce them to these things that I was in love with prior to this game coming out. And people were like, yeah, that's lame because it, like, looks like shit. I'm like, fuck you. this is where this game came from. Like, this is this history, and these are the games that influenced it. And it was just like, yeah, but it doesn't have the pretty colors and graphics. So I, like, didn't necessarily hate 7 because I thought it was a bad game back in the day. And, I mean, we're going to get more into it. I still don't think it's necessarily a bad game. I have my severe issues with it when it measures up to the rest of the series, and I don't know exactly where I'd put it nowadays. But, like, yeah, that's the gist of it. It's just like people get enamored with a certain title or a certain part of your niche, and then you try to be welcoming, and it's like everything that came before it is utter shit. And it's like, okay, well, fuck you and fuck everything this game represents, because these people are tied to it. And that was kind of my feeling for it at the time.
So the first time you played it, that was coloring your enjoyment, I would argue, right?
Not initially. I would say probably a couple months afterwards.
Okay. So how did you feel? Because you were way into JRPGs. It wasn't my first JRPG. Well, I played with some friends, some other JRPGs on the Super Nintendo. Yeah. I had solo on my own, only played, I think, Beyond the Beyond, and maybe, like, did Wild Arms 1 come out before 7? I think it did.
Well, I don't remember. I don't remember, because I, like, the only reason I got a PlayStation was even for Final Fantasy 7. Like, all the other RPGs I didn't really know about. I know it sounds...
Either way, you were...
Heresy.
You had more history playing JRPGs than I did when we both played 7.
Yeah.
So before all that stuff came in a couple months after, what was your initial feeling about the game?
That it looked really cool, that it was a good, solid RPG, a good follow-up to Final Fantasy VI. I just remember being excited to play it. I remember having a good time playing it for a while. I just played it like any other game, and I enjoyed it. And that's really why, I mean, how old was I? Fuck. Like 12? 13?
I was 13, so yeah, right around that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When I was 13, I remember enjoying it quite thoroughly. And I think the real watershed moment that kind of made me turn my back on 7 when I was that young was actually Final Fantasy VIII. Interestingly enough, I got the soundtrack to Final Fantasy VIII, and when I went to high school, sometimes I'd bring my Walkman with me, and I'd listen to the music from Final Fantasy VIII on my Walkman. And then someone was like, oh, what are you listening to? And it was the soundtrack for Final Fantasy VIII. And they put it on, and then they like made fun of me, like, oh, look at this gay music. Like, look how terrible it is. It's like, this is the thing that is supposed to be the popular thing. Like, I don't know. Like, it kind of opened that up. It opened my eyes up to what I think was a big group of people who like, you know, your dude bro gamers, right? And I kind of misconstrued that with saying like, this is part of an entire group, because yeah, like I already said, I would introduce the older ones to it and be like, oh, 2D graphics are dumb. Like, whatever. So like, there was a long time I actually did like Final Fantasy VII. I think it's more resentment. I think that resentment more showed its face when Final Fantasy VIII came out.
Interesting. Now, I know we've talked about the first time I played VII, I should walk back a little bit. I loved it. It was mind-blowing for me. I had only played a couple JRPGs on my own, aside from playing some earlier Super Nintendo. Like, I played Chrono Trigger with my friend, but I really watched him play it. I didn't get to play it myself. So, for me, 7 was probably within the first 5 JRPGs. It's hard for me to remember memories a little bit. I know Beyond the Beyond was the first one I played on my own, solo. After that, memories gets a little bit weird. But 7 was the next one to blow my mind. Beyond the Beyond only blew my mind because it was my first one, right? I actually recently replayed that, and it's a goddamn terrible grind fest. But I did it because I never beat it as a kid. And no wonder I never beat it as a kid. It was hard to beat with cheats and a strategy guide. And it was still grindy. Anyway, 7 was just absolutely mind-blowing for me. And then I never replayed it. What's interesting about 7 is I played it once. And I never replayed the original version until just like last month. I obviously consumed the extra content. Like, I watched Advent Children a bunch of times. I played through most of Dredge of Cerebus. I played through about half of Crisis Core and watched the rest on YouTube. So I stayed up to date with the expanded universe of 7, but I never replayed it until recently. And it was interesting to juxtapose playing it as an adult versus like the rosy retrospective. And I think the reason why I kept dropping it lower and lower on my list was recency bias, because I never replayed it. I played 7 once, then I played 8, and I hated 8 the first time, but I played it again the second time. The second time I loved it. I played 9 multiple times. I played 10. I played 12. I played 13. All these games I all played before 7, so that memory just kept getting like more and more dim. Playing it just barely again. Well, let's just get into it. I know you've had a lot of criticisms about the plot and the writing.
Yeah, that's my biggest criticism.
So let's get into it, because while I was playing it, I was thinking of criticisms I've heard you brought up. And I don't know if it's because I have consumed all the expanded universe stuff, but it was not that confusing and it didn't have as many plot holes is I thought it did, based on just conversation. So let's talk about your criticisms with the plot holes and the writing, and then let's start there.
And first of all, like, you can take all that additional expanded universe shit, and you can throw it out the window because at the original ending of Final Fantasy VII, none of that should exist.
Okay, explain, because I'm not sure if I agree.
Because the ending, everyone's dead. Hey, spoilers.
Wait, how is everybody dead?
What's the ending? What's the original ending of Final Fantasy VII?
Holy comes and saves the day.
Okay, and what happens after the credits?
Well, it's the way in the future, but only Red XII is, he's like on the cliff overlooking Midgar.
Red 13 with a couple puppies running through Midgar, which is entirely covered by plants. Nature has overtaken society.
I always thought that was implied that was way in the future. Is that not the case?
It's like 400 years in the future.
Okay, so of course everybody's dead. It's 400 years in the future.
But like everything is dead. Like everything, everything. You could, the implication that you get from the end of Final Fantasy VII is that, because remember that the heavy plot trope, at least in the American translation, because that's all I know, is that Holy could just as well get rid of all of humanity as well as save it.
They do mention that.
Trying to determine.
And again, I don't know if that's because I had a translation patch, but that is mentioned in the version I played recently. Buchanan mentions it.
Yeah, Holy will save the planet, but it's going to destroy everything it views as a threat to the planet. And so it suggests that Holy believed that humans were a threat to the planet. However you want to take it, because there are no humans in the ending of Final Fantasy VII. They're all gone.
That's interesting. So I interpreted it as it was more of a slow thing. Like, it didn't kill everybody right off the bat, but by the time 400 years had passed, yeah, humans were gone, but that leaves space for the expanded universe stuff to take place before that happens.
I mean, it could all be retconned. I mean, that's essentially all that Advent Children is just retconning shit. But like, you have to think about it. If humans were still alive in the expanded universe as they are, then you wouldn't see the rot and decay of a major center like Midgar like you do in the original end of Final Fantasy VII. I have to think, like, Final Fantasy VII was a complete Sakaguchi joint. I don't think any of the expanded universe has anything to do with Sakaguchi and his storytelling. I think it's just Square trying to capitalize on a brand. I don't blame them for that because, I mean, it makes money. So you got to do something, and then you have to explain why, you know, it is the way it is, and then you just kind of have to conveniently ignore some things about your own plot and story at the end of Final Fantasy VII, and that's fine. Like, Square's trying to turn a buck, and most people probably didn't even make it to the end of Final Fantasy VII who say they loved and played it. But that's a topic for another time. That's just a general video game criticism, you could say, regardless.
That's a good point. But when, because, it comes to, you know, I'd never noticed that the first time I played it. And again, I don't know if it's because I had a translation patch that's supposed to be more accurate than the original English translation. But I did notice that Buchanan, and I think it's mentioned one other time, that Holy would destroy anything that it views as a threat. And the first time I beat Final Fantasy VII, I just thought, oh, it's 400 years in the future. And I actually interpreted that as because the world gave up on Mako energy in that whole system of governance and energy and civilization. That not that humans were gone, it's just that Midgard and that system was gone. That's how I interpreted it as the first time I played it. Now, replaying it and noticing those two kind of implications, hints that Holy would destroy anything that he uses as a threat, I can see why, oh, maybe that is what it's implying, that all the humans were wiped out. Never thought about that.
Yeah, and I think the other thing too is what you say, like, you know, the way of living, that living off Mako has ceased. It's been a long time since I've watched any of the extended universe, other than Final Fantasy VII Remake, which I thought was fantastic. Anything outside the extended universe, I haven't really paid attention to. So if they went off Mako, that's fine. But they also said in the original Final Fantasy VII that if Mako kind of just shut off, almost the entirety of civilization would collapse. And then you look at Advent Children, and that's not really the case. Like, they just kind of conveniently forget how many of the benefits Mako is providing to civilization. There's towns you go to in Final Fantasy VII that say without Mako, they wouldn't be able to functionally survive. So when they're like, oh yeah, Mako is...
Well, I mean, I'm going to push back a little bit on that. Other than Midgar, what other town uses Mako? Calm doesn't use it. Wutai doesn't use it.
No. I can't remember which town it was.
Obviously, because they have a cannon.
Nibelheim does.
Nibelheim does. Okay, so I can think of two that don't use it. They're not reliant on Mako.
But it's just like the civilizations you go to are like, yeah, Mako has made life much more convenient. and Midgar, and you have to think Advent Children, doesn't the majority of that take place in Midgar?
It does. And you're right. It's been a long time since I watched Advent Children, but obviously there's like still infrastructure and buildings and power and electricity. So I would assume that they're still using Mako.
They have to.
Yeah. So, but again, the initial theory of maybe it took time for Mako to sort of dissolve and be abandoned. So I guess what I'm trying to say is I'm not sure.
You're trying to explain away a giant plot hole.
Well, no, it could be. But just the fact that, so at the end of Final Fantasy VII, after the credits, all you see is Red XXI and two puppies looking at a cliff over Midgar.
That's XIII.
XIII, excuse me, 13.
Or 13.
Yeah, correct. I think just from that one, like, what, 7 to 10 seconds of video that they give you at the end of the credits, I don't know if you can jump to the conclusion that all humans are dead just because none are shown in that short video clip. And because Midgar is gone. Because Wu Tai doesn't use Mako. And I know Calm didn't use Mako. And I'm trying to think of anywhere else. There's not actually another big city. You have the snow town in the mountains. It's like a small little town.
Yeah.
Gold Saucer's obviously gone because they need power. They're dead. Coral Town hadn't had Mako for a while because the factory was inactive and they were already living in shambles.
But okay. I mean, but we're really trying to look for an excuse as to why, like, the extended universe could exist, but that still doesn't explain anything when the majority of the expanded universe is Midgar. Like, all these other towns, they don't even matter whether or not they're going to exist in the future because everything in the expanded universe still revolves around Midgar.
Yes, but in the expanded universe, Advent Children takes place seemingly within 10 years.
Yeah.
I would say, of the original. And would everything disappear? And whereas the shot we're talking about is 400 years in the future. That's a big gap.
It's a big gap. I'm still not buying it.
Well,
we're not here to talk. I mean, honestly, are we here to talk about the extended universe, though?
That's a fair point. And
we can make this an entire episode.
We might. I'm playing. I'm playing devil's advocate because, honestly, I never noticed sort of the implication that Holy could kill humans until the second playthrough. Yeah. The first time I played it, I never noticed it. I don't know if it wasn't in the original translation. Obviously, it was in the original translation because you played the PS2 version.
That's what I played, yeah.
Yeah, so I just didn't pick up on it the first time I played. And so I can see why you would make that jump with the final credit scene. And that's probably, all being fair, that's probably what Sakaguchi envisioned.
Maybe. Sakaguchi, as he envisioned Final Fantasy VII, he wrote the plot while he was grieving his mother, who had just died prior to that game. And that was the entire mindset while developing the plot for Final Fantasy VII. So what he was thinking during that time, that could mean a lot. You know, that maybe that helps you reinterpret what you think about Aerith's death, or Aerith's, or whatever you want to call her. That could be something different in how you view that. And maybe that's why Aerith's death is so much more emotionally impactful from just a cinematography point of view than any other of the previous deaths in the Final Fantasy series, which there are multitudes of, because she is not the first one to have died. Contrary to everyone's opinion in 1998, even though this was a 1997 game, by 1998, people were thinking that.
But that's a good point.
Like, oh, it's never happened before.
Why did her death resonate so much harder than the previous deaths in the franchise? Is it just because
people hadn't played those games?
That's a good point, because I would say the majority, I mean, Final Fantasy VII sold so well. What is the, do you know the official numbers off the top of your head?
Not the official numbers, but I think it's the second best PlayStation.
I think it's two
second
or three
best selling PlayStation game of all time.
Yeah.
Behind like Gran Turismo 1 or 2, I think 2.
It's up there. It's a lot. So a lot of those are, yeah, you're right. A lot of those are people who have never played a JRPG before. Never played a Final Fantasy. That's a good point.
Never. And they're used to platformers. Like, by the time that a lot of people got to Final Fantasy VII, they were your my age. You know, they were 12, 13, 14, 15. They're somewhere in that range area. So they are used to, first of all, they're not used to story-driven games, first and foremost. Second, they aren't used to seeing anyone that's important to the player character's party
die.
Like, whatever the genre may be, leaving forever. Like, dying. The people were not used to that. So when they saw that, they were like, this is a character that's part of my main party group. Like, they're not gone forever, right? Because that didn't happen in platformers. Like in Mario Yoshi didn't die forever.
True.
You know, yeah. You have to kind of think of the baseline of what most people were coming into most people who played video games were coming into the Final Fantasy VII.
And even though there was previous deaths in the Final Fantasy franchise, I would also argue the average JRPG did not kill off a main character. Still doesn't kill off a main character on average.
Yeah. And let's even break that down. Spoilers for Final Fantasy, by the way, the series as a whole. So I'm going to be very brief. Final Fantasy IV had Tella die, and Tella's an old dude anyway. And like, people like Tella. I'm not saying Tella doesn't matter, but like, Tella was kind of a character that wasn't part of your final party and wasn't a character you could constantly go back to anyway. So no one cares. I mean, they care, but you know what I'm saying? And then like, Final Fantasy V was Galoof, but in the United States, we didn't get Galoof. Because there was no Final Fantasy V in the United States. So that wasn't a thing. And all the characters that die in Final Fantasy II, you don't get. The characters that die in Final Fantasy III, you don't get, because those games didn't come over to the United States. And then the characters that die in Final Fantasy VI are impactful, but they're not major party members. Like, Cid can die. He's supposed to die. You can save him, but he's not a major party member. Leo dies, and you do play as Leo in your party, but he's not a major party member. So you don't see these, like, the Final Fantasies and the RPGs that we got here in the United States, at least the major ones, you didn't have anything like that, even though they did exist in the Final Fantasy series. And even, like, you could say, like, Phantasy Star is another example, but I don't know anyone who had a Genesis outside of, like, my one friend who had a Genesis to play RPGs. Exactly. Like, that just wasn't a thing.
It wasn't.
People didn't get the Genesis in the United States to play Phantasy Star. And if anyone's listening is like, well, that was me. Okay, great. You're like part of 10 people. Congratulations.
That's why I was such a shock. Phantasy Star picked up with online. That's when it got huge.
Yeah, I would agree with that. But Phantasy Star 4 was a pretty big fucking
deal.
But no one, I mean, this was before Final Fantasy 7. So were people really playing Phantasy Star 4? No, but I think of that as like an RPG fan, that Phantasy Star 4 is known to be one of the bigger releases, because from an RPG perspective, it was. But again, like, I would be shocked if that game sold over 100,000 copies in the United States.
Yeah, I would agree. So that's a good point. That makes sense why it her death res, because for a lot of people, it was the first time. Actually, for most people,
yes.
The lion's share of people, that was the first time they experienced anything like that. Playing it through the second time, even knowing it, because I knew it was coming, I paid attention to her dialogue. Now, for those who played Final Fantasy VII, you know there's a date mechanic. And because I played through with the strategy guide, because I wanted to make sure I got everything, didn't miss anything. The strategy guide, it really explains all the different parts of the game, depending on what you do, how it decides who shows up in the date scene at the Gold Saucer. For those who never played it, there's like a theme park in the game, and based on how you interact with different characters, you go on a date with someone, and that person can change depending on how you've interacted with different characters. I had a specific character in mind, Tifa, that I wanted, because the very first time I played in Final Fantasy VII, I don't know if I was just like too young and I was a dick and I thought girls were stupid, but I got Barret as my date, and I was kind of pissed about it.
That's really hard to do.
Yeah, and I was a little pissed about it. So this time playing around, I'm like, okay, I think Tifa's just hot shit, right?
Oh, you like her boobs. I get it.
Yeah, she's cool, and I like brunettes. She's got big boobs. She's brunette. She kicks ass. She freaking knows kung fu. She punches people in the face. I mean, come on.
She's a strong, independent woman. She has a job. She's a business owner.
She's a bartender. I think bartending is hot.
She's a bartender, and she owns the bar.
I thought Barret owns the bar.
It's Tifa's seventh heaven.
Oh, that's a good point. That is a good point.
She owns the bar.
She owns the bar. You're right. You're right. See, that makes me even hotter. It makes her even hotter. So I wanted Tifa, so I had this weird interplay where I wanted to experience all the Aerith scenes and pay attention to them because I knew she was going to die. I say Aerith. I don't know why. I don't know if it's Aerith. Whatever's right. I say Aerith.
I don't care. I interchange it.
Yeah. And
Square fucked it.
Another thing that I noticed is Aerith, I did not pick up the first time I played, but Aerith knows way more than she lets on. I picked up on that the second time. Like, oh, I almost think she knew she was going to die. when she left.
She knew a lot more than that. That's why I don't like her. Or I like any of the characters, really. But yeah.
Now, one thing that you've made a complaint about in the past that I specifically paid attention to in this playthrough is you said none of the characters have a motivation to follow Cloud after Midgar.
I don't think so.
I disagree.
Okay.
So we're going to get into that. Now.
Okay.
Okay. First off, Barrett. Let's go with Barrett first.
Okay.
This dude is a terrorist hippie. He cares so much about the planet.
Yes.
He's willing to commit terrorist acts, blow up infrastructure, probably kill a bunch of innocent people. They don't outright say it, but like, I don't know how many workers are in the factory. I'm assuming somebody died when we blew it up. They had to have, right?
They kind of mentioned that when Sector 7 is about to get crushed. And I think Jesse and Biggs kind of mentioned that they know they killed innocent people.
Yes. I thought it was heavily implied that people died during the first bombing mission. And Barrett's totally willing to do that because he thinks the planet is so, it's very important to save the planet. So when you get to the end of Midgar, you know Sephiroth is a threat to the planet. So it's not a far stretch for me for Barrett to throw everything under the sun, leave his daughter to go off and save the planet, because he's already illustrated he's super irrational when it comes to that subject. He's like hardcore hippie.
Sure.
So that's Barrett's motivation, in my opinion.
And see, this is where I gotta disagree, man, because his motivation is, you're right, his motivation is to save the planet, but his motivation is squarely on Shinra. Now, I could understand if Barrett had said when they left, like, hey, I'm going to tag along with you until I get out of the city far enough that I can recoup because Avalanche has been destroyed. I have no other people, but I got to get back at Shinra. So for him just all of a sudden to be like, oh, fuck Sephiroth, because of this dude you just kind of met that was a mercenary
Sephiroth
for hire.
Represents Shinra and Mako and all this stuff. And you're right. He has this shame about Coral Town and what happened there. And he's trying to like almost redeem himself by saving the planet, I think, is sort of the implication. So it wasn't for me.
I think his beef's with Shinra.
And Sephiroth is like a product of Shinra. And he's not just going to suck out Mako. He's going to summon a fucking comet and blow the whole planet up.
You would think that Barrett would almost empathize with Sephiroth then. Come on, man. He's like a fucking hippie. Like, here's a dude that says, fuck everything that's going on the planet. I'm just going to blow it up and kill all humanity. Like, at least, like, Barrett might not be chill with that. Like, the planet blowing up and people dying. But at least I think he would be empathetic towards Sephiroth, which is never communicated. And it's because his entire beef is with Shinra.
His beef was with Shinra. Why? Because they're sucking Mako. And all the elevators, there's like the two elevator scenes where he goes off on a ramp. His beef is with they're sucking Mako out, and that's killing the planet.
No, you're right. But the key to that is because, like you said, in Coral Town, Barrett, like, lost his arm, lost his friend, lost everything because Shinra came in and built a power plant for Coral Town. And then when that power plant was sabotaged by members in Coral Town, they took it out on the citizens of Coral Town and just razed the city. His beef is squarely with Shinra. So for him to just kind of be like, yeah, this guy who just joined us, who's kind of a distant douchebag, I'm just going to give everything up and follow him.
Well, he had nothing to give up.
At that point, sure, but it wouldn't be like enthusiastically follow this dude, because he would probably be like, I got to recoup and find a way to get back at Shinra. Or maybe he would move to another district in Midgar, because Midgar is his kind of base of operations. If that was kind of communicated at all, I could kind of understand it.
I thought it was.
Kind of became a
man, even though I just played
it. I don't think it was presented as him being standoffish. It was just kind of like, yeah, we got to stop Sephiroth. Why the fuck do you care about Sephiroth, bro?
Because he's going to kill the planet.
He doesn't care about Sephiroth killing the planet. He cares about Shinra killing the planet because he doesn't really care about the killing of the planet. He's out for revenge against Shinra.
Okay, so that's where we differ a little bit. I interpreted him, yes, he cares about Shinra, but I also think he cares about the planet.
I'm sure he does, but I think it's secondary to the fact that he hates Shinra.
Okay. So if that comes down to interpretation of his motivations, which you might be right, I admit. When I was playing through with it, right when you killed, you know, the roller robot at the end of the highway, I forget what the boss is called, and then all the characters kind of say their thing, why they're going to follow Cloud. to the next section of the game, disc two. I thought Barrett said something along the lines of like, yeah, the planet is still in danger and Sephiroth is going to, and I thought like, okay, this point, dude's a hippie, so I get it.
And at that point, why isn't Barrett the leader? Like, why aren't they following Barrett?
Because he's a shitty leader. No one respects him. He's like hot-headed and he's got bad tactical plan. Everybody knows he's got a good heart, but he's like kind of a shitty leader.
So then Tifa should be the leader. Because let me break this down.
She would be better than Cloud, honestly, I think.
Far better.
Yes.
Far better. And that's another part that irritated me. So you have Barrett that, like, it should have been communicated that he was following Cloud out of, like, sheer convenience and his objective was still Shinra. I don't see realistically Barrett giving a fuck about Sephiroth, right? Especially right after Sephiroth killed the president of Shinra. He would have been like,
Shinra's still around. It didn't collapse. Shinra Rufus took over.
Right. But like at some point he'd been like, I may not like Sephiroth, but I respect him with that mindset. That would have been Bear. That should have been Bear's mindset. It wasn't, but that's fine. I mean, we can have that disagreement there all day. Now Tifa knows that Cloud's insane, but I think there was something that said like the Mako kind of like erased her memories. But, like, she knows that something's up with Cloud. And that could be a Mako thing. I think I've seen that retconned later. Like, they're like, yeah, I kind of forgot things because of the Mako. And now, like, well, I forgot more, that.
So this is something maybe you don't remember or it was new to me. But yeah. When you do this, when you go to the back to the Shinra mansion and you get the extra Zack scene, I forgot that. So after Cloud, the real story is that Cloud was just one of the regular Shinra soldiers during the Nibelheim incident. Zack gets his ass kicked by Sephiroth. Cloud takes his helmet off, picks up Zack's sword, sneaks up on Sephiroth, stabs him. Sephiroth falls into the live stream with Genova.
That's not how it ends. He slashes Sephiroth. He tries to take Tifa out. Cloud takes it, like tries to get Tifa out of there. Sephiroth comes back, finds Cloud. Like, impales Cloud on his fucking giant sword.
Yes, 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 yes.
And then Cloud, like, further impales himself, lifts Sephiroth up, and throws him off that pipe.
Oh, yes, and then he falls into the live stream. Correct. And that was I was diving into, like, how is Cloud so powerful, and a lot of people were saying, this all happened before Cloud was injected with heavy Mako and Genova cells. So I was trying to figure out, how is Cloud so powerful? Well, what happens after that, he's recovered by Hojo, him and Zack. Hojo puts them in the fucking like tubes in the bottom of Shinra
Mako chambers or whatever,
whatever they're called, and he injects them both with high dose Mako and Genova cells. See, Sephiroth, so second generation S cells, Sephiroth cells. That's why Cloud is so fucked up when Zack breaks them out. The reason Zack is not as fucked up is he was already soldier first class. He was more resilient. He'd already been infused with Mako, so it wasn't like an overwhelming thing. But when Zack dies, Cloud is like traumatized from the whole experience. He got impaled by Sephiroth, gets put into a tube, then gets injected with a bunch of shit. Then Zack saves him. He watches Zack die. And then Zack tells him, you got to live for, this is in Crisis Core. Zack tells him, you got to live for both of us. But I guess that's a little retconned. And so then Cloud has all these like confidence issues combined with Zack telling him, you need to live for both of us. And his memory's all jacked up. I can kind of see why Cloud was crazy. He didn't remember everything and why he assumed he was first class. That made a little more sense to me.
Straight crazy.
But what doesn't make sense is when Sephiroth impales him, this is before Cloud was given any sort of extra human abilities. He's just like a regular dude.
Yeah.
And he survives an impaling by the most powerful being on the planet and throws him off.
I think he wouldn't have survived if Hojo didn't put him in that little tube.
Okay, but he survived long enough.
I think that's kind of implied.
Okay. But still, though, like, so the red threads I was reading was Cloud had a high potential already when his emotions were high. It's just that he didn't have the confidence to access that potential, which made sense. And then he gets put in the tube, gets all the juice, gets all the Mako steroids and the Genova cell steroids. So then when he comes out of it, he takes Zack's sword, takes on his identity. He may not have, like, the training, but he has the raw power. Because of all the Hojo's experiments on it. Now,
again, you said S2 cells. They never talk about injecting Sephiroth cells into Cloud in the original. That's additional extended universe.
That's Crisis Core. Yeah.
Yeah, extended universe shit. And I don't think you can get into that because that extended universe was never intended to exist.
What you do know, which is in Final Fantasy VII, is after that whole incident, he was put into a vat and experimented on by Hojo. No, you're 100%. Right. No, when Hojo, when you encounter Hojo for the boss fight on the top of the Sister Ray gun, he says that he thought you were a failure, but you're actually the only success. And I think he does imply that he injected you with Genova cells.
It's possible. No, you did get Genova cells, yes. He did get Genova cells. That's 100% true. He's a clone. Yes. Well, that's why they call him a clone, is because he gets that shit.
Yes.
He's not a clone.
So at the very least, he got Mako and Genova cells. If you count Crisis Core, he also got Sephiroth. So.
Yeah, because of course he did. Why wouldn't he?
Well, because you got to explain why he's so badass and he can go toe-to-toe with Sephiroth.
So I think I'm going to kind of back off by saying that, like, I don't understand why people are following Cloud. The only one I don't understand is Barrett. But to break him down, Tifa's following him because Tifa's a horrible person.
No, I think...
Maybe, possibly.
So you have the scene later, where this relates to her following at the end of Midgar. You have the scene later where they both fall in the live stream and Tifa helps him recover his memories and the truth of his identity, that he actually never made it the soldier.
Yeah.
And I thought it implied that Tifa has this, like, weird crush on him.
No, it's totally it. No, you're entirely right.
Like an irrational crush where she would just follow him even though it makes no sense.
And, well, the thing I've deduced from this is that the reason she's following Cloud, that's why I don't like Tifa, is that she's trying to use Cloud to accomplish her own ambitions because she sees Cloud as very strong and very powerful. And she has a lot of the same goals and ambitions that Barrett has. She's part of Avalanche.
True.
So that's a good point. She's a hippie too. She's
part of that whole thing. Yeah.
Yes. She's part of it. And she sees a familiar friend. She sees that he's become stronger. She doesn't remember him being a soldier, but apparently in her mind, maybe he did. It's questionable. I'll even go so far to say it's questionable that she remembers him at Niflheim. That she remembers him there because she was knocked the fuck out. So maybe she doesn't remember Cloud there at all.
Seriously traumatized and injured by the time that he.
She may have forgotten Cloud was there and just assumed that he had become a soldier over time, even though she doesn't remember him being a soldier. But she sees him, dropped off at Midgar. I think that's a scene that is in the original Final Fantasy VII that she did recover him.
Yes, she recovered.
Yeah, she recovered him at the train station. So she's gonna buy in. Oh, he became a soldier because that's what she remembers. But she also is like, I can use this dude from my history and kind of charm him in order to accomplish my own ambitions. So kind of a bitch in that sense. I can't blame her, but moving on, Red 13, of course, is going to follow who the fuck ever because he just wants to get home. I think that's pretty well explained. Red 13 has a pretty good arc, pretty good plot line.
They also explain why after he does get home, he continues to follow because Bugenhagen tells him that's
yes.
So that makes sense.
Like, Red 13 has probably the clearest motivation of every single one of these characters. Except for maybe Kate Sheet.
Well, that's true. Kate Sheet is a spy, so that makes total sense.
Yeah, he's a spy. He's supposed to keep an eye on them. He's just going to do whatever. Because probably Rufus, even before President Shinra die, Rufus takes over with Reeve. And Reeve is like, he wants to see what's happening with them. And probably Rufus, Shinra doesn't know. It seems like Reeve is doing this all on his own. Shinra.
I got that, like, maybe some people knew, but Reeve was in this weird spot where he respected the party, but he was also kind of playing both sides, because eventually he gets arrested and put in confinement, whatever.
But at least, like, it's explained. Like, the reason he's with them is because he wants to see what they're up to.
Yes.
And then Aerith, she knows Zack's dead, dude. She knows Zack's dead. She talks to the 100%. Fucking planet.
100%.
She knows he's dead. She knows Cloud knows who Zack is. That's kind of the conversation they have when they're in the park right outside Sector 7, I think, I think it's Sector 7. It's implied she knows that Cloud knows Zack and that Cloud is acting weird. Cloud is not the real Cloud and Cloud's acting more like Zack than actually Cloud. And it's implied that she knows that because she talks to the planet. So the only reason she's following, I don't know. Like, it's fucking weird. So Aerith is fucking weird.
So again, this all comes back to, I remember you saying, I don't think it makes sense that anybody follows Cloud after Midgar. We don't have a consensus on Barrett. We can agree to disagree on that one.
Sure.
Tifa, I agree with you. It makes sense because she's kind of a bitch and she's manipulative. Just this weird crush thing. I can kind of follow that. Kate Seath makes sense. Red 13 makes sense. Aerith, again, I don't know. This is something new, but I feel like she saw the whole thing in advance and that she actually knew she was going to die by Sephiroth's hand. And that was kind of her path and she accepted it. That's the, after playing through it and thinking about it, and I told you, I realized the second playthrough, she knew way more than she let on that I noticed the first time. Agreed, she knew about that. Oh,
yeah, you read between the lines. Yeah, absolutely.
And when I read between the lines, I'm like, I think she followed him because she sort of saw this was her. I don't know if she saw everything in detail, but she was following the call of the planet. And the planet was leading her this direction. And I think by the time she leaves and goes to the Temple of the Ancients by herself to pray for Holy, I think she knows she's going to die. That's why she says goodbye to Cloud. She has some final words. And he has that dream sequence where he sees her in the forest. And she gives him some parting words. And don't worry about me. Don't mourn over me. I think she, at least at that point, I think she knows she's going to die. Now, at the Midgar point, I don't know if she knows all that yet. But she's just sort of following the spirit, so to speak.
Yeah. But she knows Cloud is out of his fucking mind.
Yes.
So she knows Cloud is out of his mind. Tifa probably has a very good idea that Cloud is out of his fucking head. Barret doesn't necessarily really like Cloud. He's more of a tool of necessity. Red 13 is just grateful. And yeah. Kate Sith is a spy. So right now, like, all of your characters are terrible human beings. Except for Red 13.
He just wants to go home. I get it. Yeah.
He's just like, please don't make me fuck a bitch. I don't want to fuck a bitch.
Oh yeah, that's because when you first find him, Kojo's gonna try to make a mate. Yeah. That's hilarious. Yeah, so I would agree that I wouldn't say all of them are good people, but for me, I was playing it with that in mind because I've heard you raise that concern, and that at the end of the highway scene, I felt like, I mean, they may not be crystal clear. But to me, I felt like everybody had at least an understandable motivation to follow Cloud.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not. That's like I said, I'll back kind of back off on that criticism. I haven't made that criticism in the past. I'll back off it. But I still think that, I don't know, it's very strange. Because that's when the world opens up. You'd think they'd have a general idea of how big the world is outside of Midgar. And I also think that's not really well communicated or it's understood, because it's like, yeah, now we just got to go around the world and go like on this voyage that doesn't necessarily totally make sense or isn't understood, or where they need to go is totally understood. And it seems like they don't understand the scope of the world once they get outside of Midgar as well. And they're all from outside of Midgar.
I would agree with all of that, but that was kind of the point. It was like they were stepping out. They were like taking this step. Like, we don't really know all the details, but we're going to pursue Sephiroth because we don't really know what else.
Yeah. And that's again, I think like even with Tifa, it seems like, cause when you're on the boat from Junon to Costa del Sol, you're talking to Tifa and it doesn't like, it's completely weird. The things she says, it's like, I don't like soldiers or uniforms or fighting. I'm all about peace. And I'm a pacifist. It's like, bitch, you just blew up half of Midgar and you had no problem with it. Like, you are a soldier. Grow the fuck up.
I would say that is a contradiction, is, again, as an older person playing it, understanding, like, the bombing mission that you start the game out with is a terrorist attack, and you kill a...
They're eco-terrorists.
You're eco-terrorists. They're
totally eco-terrorists.
You're hippie terrorists. Yeah. Exactly. That's what I was saying about Barret. And that's a good point that Tifa is totally bought in, right? She's probably one step below Barret in conviction. With being an
eco-terrorist. She's just not as vocal about it, but, like, you hear her say that she's vocal. And I'm not saying, like, this is an extreme character flaw. It's just who Tifa is.
Yes.
It's what she is. It's what's defining her. So she seems hard up on Shinra too. So you think following Sephiroth is like her number one priority? Maybe not at the top of her mind, but she, like you said, it could be an infatuation with Cloud. But even I think that infatuation goes so far when you're using him as a means to an end. So it's complicated, but I don't think it's intentionally so. That's why I think my favorite character in all of this is Yuffie, because I think her entire arc and her entire character, she just wants to tag along with them to get materia, and she has nothing better to do for the glory of Wutai. Like her entire motivation is well explained.
I was gonna bring that up when you do the Pagodoa quest and you get Leviathan material and you beat the Pagodoa. Yeah. Again, I can't pronounce anything correctly, so just bear with it. But when you get to top, even her dad tells her, "Hey, when it's all said and done, come back with some good material."
Yeah, exactly.
Which I thought was hilarious.
Everything about Yuffie is adorable, and it's completely understandable. I would say Vincent too. Vincent has more motivation.
He's my favorite
to go
character.
After Sephiroth.
He's my favorite character.
He has more. Yeah, like if you're like, is there any character that would willingly follow Cloud out of every single character? The only one is Vincent.
I mean, he literally says, like, you find him in the coffin. There's one thing I don't like about Vincent's presentation.
Yeah.
When you first find him, why the fuck does he have the powers of levitation?
Because he was injected with shit.
Okay.
Like, he's immortal.
He does that one time. You get him out of the coffin. He flies out. He, like, does the Jesus pose, and he hovers over the coffin. He talks to you, and he says, never mind, leave me alone. Then as you're leaving, he comes out, and he asks one simple question. Do you think you will run across Hojo? And they say yes. And he goes, okay, I'm in.
Yeah. Yeah.
That makes
his
total
motivations
sense.
Are clear.
Yeah.
I know there are people out there that do not like Vincent.
He's the best. What are they smoking?
His motivations are the clearest and most sensical out of your entire party.
And when you find out what happens with
Hojo.
With Lucia and her being impregnated, and he tried to stop all of that in the flashback scenes. Yeah, that makes all sense. I just thought, like, if he has the power to levitate and fly, why is that never used later in the game? Why does he never use that? I don't know.
Yeah.
It kind of was just weird to me. But other than that, he's my favorite.
He does with his limit break, so he could have been, I don't know, one of the limit breaks that flies. So, who knows? But, like, Cloud thinks Sephiroth is dead. Like, I don't know why he's all hard up on it. It's just weird. Tifa may or may not think Sephiroth is dead. Barret probably doesn't care about Sephiroth. Aerith probably knows that Sephiroth is in the life stream up to no good and keeps her mouth shut. Red 13 has no fucking idea. He just wants to go home. Keishi is a spy. He's a terrible character. There's nothing good about him other than he's a cute, fat, giant mugle. And Yuffie is fantastic. And Vincent has clear motivations. And is
one thing I
will,
I actually, with Keishi, when you find out that he's a spy and he takes the material or the key at Gold Saucer and throws it to the helicopter, the Shinra helicopter? Like, when you find out he's a spy, I forget the exact scenario. But then he goes like, hey, you guys might as well just let me continue to tag along because I have nothing better to do. And you're like, okay.
Yeah, sure. Why not?
Why not?
Like, this
that part,
yeah,
that
you know
part
what?
To me.
I don't even know why he's there.
That part made me like, what the fuck? I would kill that motherfucker. You know you're not going to come back. You just betrayed me. And like, what? I'm just going to let you tag along after you betrayed me? That part made no sense to me. I will agree.
No, their trust for Keishi is makes no sense. Keishi is a horrible character. Like, I used to, like, be one of those defenders of him, like, way back in the day, and then I replayed him, like, oh, he is that bad. Like, ooh, like, he's awful. He's bad. That is a bad character. And remember, like, when he dies,
and
he's like, oh, I'm gonna shrink down, I'm gonna get crushed. It's like, you're a fucking robot.
Yeah, nobody, we know that you're just a remote control robot. There's no human inside of there. We don't care if you die. I agree. When the Temple of Ancients, and then he gets crushed, and then they try to make a big deal out of it, and then 5 minutes later, there's like a new KC that goes back. Hey, I'm the new version. That was stupid.
Yeah. I'm Keishi number two. Like, I was like, I wonder if it's gonna hurt. Like, you're a, what is, Okay.
That was weird. Another thing that I don't know if this is but the case, but I interpreted that Sephiroth, we talked about this in Discord to an extent. Yeah. I don't think Sephiroth is alive ever. I don't even think Sephiroth is alive in the crystal in the northern crater. I think just his body is still there and Genova's using it. But
yes,
I don't. And you kind of turned me on to this as I was playing Seven. We were chatting, and then I finished the game, and I thought, you know what? Because I didn't pick up that every time you encounter Sephiroth during the game, it's actually Genova. It's like a clone or projection of Genova, because you see Sephiroth, and then you fight some like Genova Death or Genova Life or whatever version of Genova Synthesis. I forget all the different versions. And you're actually encountering pieces of Genova that are trying to get home. And then when you finally get to the Northern Crater, and then you give Sephiroth the black materia, and he's encased in that crystal, but he's only got like one half. His bottom half is gone. I think it's Genova just using his body as some sort of container. And the only time that you fight a piece of actual Sephiroth, I think even the final boss of Sephiroth, the first version of Sephiroth you fight is Bizarro Sephiroth, and he's all mutated, right? He's got all these weird, similar to Genova. And then when you fight one winged angel, the bottom half is like multiple legs. He's like all mutated. He's not the human version of Sephiroth. I think you're just fighting Genova in different forms. And that Sephiroth really did die. He's gone. And the whole the actual antagonist is Genova the entire time. It's never Sephiroth. Minus at the very end when Cloud goes internal. Then you have the final scene where it's just like you and Sephiroth in like the black space. And you do Omni Slash. Yeah. That's Cloud, in my mind, killing like the internal battle he has with Sephiroth, the rivalry, or maybe the S cells if you count Crisis Core. But
Cloud is killing his internal strife.
He's exactly, and that's heavily implied because when you wake up from that, you're on a crater and Tifa's like trying to grab your hand. The crater's imploding, and it's straight out. It's not even implied. It's just that was all in his head. That whole scene happened in his head, which means Sephiroth, he's never actually the antagonist. He's been dead. He actually has been dead.
Yes. Yeah. I would love to hear a case that Sephiroth's not dead and you're not fighting Genova. Like the entire thing is you are fighting Genova. Like Genova's using Sephiroth as kind of like this manifestation of a life form on Earth, because Genova's an alien.
Exactly.
Genova is kind of similar to Lavos. Like Chrono Trigger. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like Lavos. Genova came to the planet and then inhabited the ancients. And then once Genova found a way to, like, Sephiroth saved Genova from everything on the
from Shinra. That
encapsulation.
Yeah.
Yeah. From Shinra. So probably Genova as like just some sort of power or some side of, some higher power, some sort of being, views Sephiroth as a savior to itself or herself or however you want to term it. So it's using that manifestation of that power of that savior of Genova to manifest that and present itself as what it views as the strongest human on the planet. You can almost go religious with it and say there's like a holy trinity to it. If you want to get on the deep religious spectrum of it, that Sephiroth is kind of like the Jesus figure. Genova is God, and the life stream is the Holy Spirit, in a sense.
I can see that.
Genova is this God and is presenting itself through the physical manifestation of Sephiroth, who is the representation of the Jesus figure. But Sephiroth isn't necessarily his own person, he isn't his own being. It's the physical manifestation of Genova, i.e. God.
I agree.
You're right. Sephiroth, by all extent that you can tell in the plot, is dead and has been dead since before the beginning of Final Fantasy VII. It's just that Genova has no other way to feel like it can best represent herself than other through the form of Sephiroth.
Agreed. Which makes me agree with your... Now, that's the part with the retcon with Advent Children that I agree with.
Yeah.
When Sephiroth comes back, it's like, okay... I mean, you could argue that he was dead. But the whole plot of Advent Children is you have these Sephiroth clones, the three, I forget their names. What are their names?
I don't remember. I don't care. One of them was like Genesis Kuja, or something like that.
Or no, Kuja's in 9.
Genesis, Mega Drive, and 32X.
Either way, like for some reason, those three combine and resurrect Sephiroth. I mean, I suppose... I don't know. Like that part, I'm like, okay. So part of me agrees with you, with your after playing it, the contrarian views. I think the retcon in in Advent Children with Sephiroth coming back, does not vibe with the actual plot of Final Fantasy VII. That part I agree with. The part that I didn't agree with was everyone's motivation at the end of Midgar. So I'm like 50-50 on that one.
I think we're not in exact alignment, but we're more in alignment than originally we were. Is that fair? Me more conforming to your point than you on mine.
Now, other things about 7 I wanted to bring up just in hindsight. I uploaded all the bosses from 7 and all the bosses from 8, and I'm almost ready to upload all the bosses from 9. One big difference is the runtime of the 8 and 9 bosses is at an hour. The runtime of all the bosses in 7 is at 2 hours. It's already uploaded. So if you're on the YouTube channel, you want to see what Final Fantasy VII, the OG, not the remake, looks like with all the best mods at 60 frames a second in 4K, I've already got it uploaded. All the bells and whistles. If you don't want to spend fucking 4 days yelling at your screen trying to get these goddamn mods to work, and you want to just see what it looks like and live vicariously through me, I've done the work. But what was interesting is that it was double the amount of actual like video time to put all the bosses in one video for Final Fantasy VII than it was 8 and 9, which leads me to, so it's not only are there more bosses, now some of that is because Emerald Weapon and Ruby Weapon take 20 minutes each, minimum.
Sure.
But still, that's 40 minutes, and I'm more than double the runtime. So there's just more content when it comes to bosses in Final Fantasy VII, but there's also more content. There's like way more side. Like you have the CPR minigame, you have all the Gold Saucer minigames. What I noticed is like, even though Final Fantasy VII was the first of the three on the PlayStation, you would think that it would be smaller in scope as far as all the different things they tried to do. But mm-hmm. I got the sense of like, that's actually, it's not a bigger game on disc because there's less, those two things in particular I noticed, which I didn't remember being the case until I recently played all three.
You know, it does have more shit. And again, it doesn't necessarily make it better, but what I will say is like, there's stuff that happens in Final Fantasy VIII because the most recent one I played was Final Fantasy VIII. And like, there's still plenty of minigames in 8 and in 9. I will say in 9, they don't necessarily feel like minigames. They feel like things that are more attached to the
plot. You have like card and jump rope. That's about it.
Well, you also have like that minigame where you're trying to fight off monsters or
the hunt,
the Moogle minigame. Oh, and there's like a Chocobo minigame.
That's what I was going to say. So
Pocket Station.
I will say this, Final Fantasy VII. So all of them have the Chocobo aspect, right? Final Fantasy VII's Chocobo breeding is the most tedious out of all the Chocobo.
Sure. Sure. And that's where it comes down. Like, here's the thing, too, is that with all the minigames between all of the three PlayStation ones, Final Fantasy VII's are, one, probably the most fun, and two, probably, like, I understand why they're doing them within context of the plot. Like, why am I snowboarding? Like, yeah, it's still kind of stupid that you snowboard.
But I'm on a glacier and I gotta get down. Yeah.
But you're on a glacier and you gotta get down. Why am I doing a motorcycle mini game with my Buster Sword? Because you're trying to escape the city on your motorcycle. You know, why am I doing a tower defense game at Fort Condor?
Oh, yeah.
But like, why am I doing this? It's like, because you're trying to protect the mountain. Like, everything is contextual there. And it has a purpose, even though if it doesn't serve a long purpose towards the goal of the overall game. It provides a nice little mini game. It provides a nice little distraction, even if it's not like a major focus. Now, like Final Fantasy VIII has the card game that has a major focus, but it's not mandatory. Final Fantasy IX has a card game that is not so major focus, but it is mandatory. You even go to Final Fantasy X, where you see a mini game that's very well developed in Blitzball that's not mandatory at all. Even though you have less mini games in Final Fantasy X, by far, they're more focused on. So yeah, I mean, there's less focus on like polishing up the mini games. But I think like between Final Fantasy VII and Final Fantasy X, the mini games in Final Fantasy X are at least fun. I mean, Final Fantasy VII are at least fun until you get to Final Fantasy X where you have Blitzball. I know, divisive. I love Blitzball, but I will say like between Final Fantasy VII and Final Fantasy X, Triple Triad withstanding, the mini games are just kind of blah. And everything in Final Fantasy VII actually kind of succeeds, even if it's aged poorly. Like, I had a lot of fun playing the motorcycle mini game. I had a lot of fun playing the snowboarding mini game. Like, these were things that were fun. They weren't the best experiences overall, if you really wanted games oriented towards that, but like, they were fantastic. They were fantastic little diversions that you could have fun individually with that weren't whole experiences. Your bite-sized experiences, kind of like a Game & Watch or a Tiger LCD thing. They're like addicted like crack for no real good reason other than They're just.
Well, fun. I like that they introduce all the minigames contextually with the plot, but then they're also unlocked in Gold Saucer. And they actually, again, right. That's contextual. Well, you have a theme park with minigames. That's why you're playing these minigames. It's part of a theme park. The only part about Gold Saucer that didn't make contextual sense to me is how the fuck is Gold Saucer staying solvent when the town built around Gold Saucer is a shanty town and is dead?
I mean,
but that's the only way.
What was Las Vegas for years? what's outside of Vegas?
Yeah, but that's like saying besides the Strip, everything else in Vegas is a homeless, decrepit, dead town. I've been to Henderson.
What was it like in the 90s? It was kind of like that in the 90s.
Well, maybe I don't remember in the 90s, but I've been to the Henderson and all these outskirts of Vegas.
Yeah.
They're nice places. Maybe in the 90s it was shit, but that's one thing that made sense. Like, if Gold Saucer is this giant attraction, wouldn't that make Coral Town a little nicer just due to tourism?
Yeah, like, it depends on how they're getting there, I guess. I mean, if the only way to get the Gold Saucer is through Coral Town, Coral Town should be swimming in cash.
It should
right?
be, but it's not.
Like, there should be resorts, and there should be hotels, and there should be, like, ghost tours or some shit of all the people that died in the Coral explosion. Like, that would be some shit that you would expect to fucking find there.
Yeah, that didn't make sense to me, but I love that, you know, you first unlock a minigame through some contextual plot, and then that minigame is available in the Gold Saucer. The only one I don't think is fun is the submarine game.
Oh, that sucks.
That one sucks. The rest of
it's
them
so
are
bad.
Fun. So I noticed that about Final Fantasy VII. Just more content, more shit in general. It's not always better, but just a grander scope.
Yeah.
And then the last but not least, like I would think about the plot of Final Fantasy VII. And again, some of this might be biased because I did get into the extended universe. I didn't like the remake. I know you liked the remake. I bought the remake day one. I got emotional on the opening credits. I literally, not wept, but I legit like had some solid tears.
Welled up.
When like the Final Fantasy VII comes up in the Midgar shot and the theme comes on and then it dives in and then you have the train, you know, they remake that iconic opening scene. I got like super emotional. And that lasted about an hour until Sephiroth showed up and I realized that Final Fantasy VII remake meant we're remaking the timeline and not just the remake of the original game. And I said, fuck you and your Kingdom Hearts shit. And I literally threw the game in the trash and I never beat it. I was so angry.
Oh, okay. Like I thought you said literally throw it in the trash. So you don't have it anymore.
I don't have it. It's gone.
It's in the trash. You threw it away.
And it got sent to the dump. Fuck you. If I wanted Kingdom fucking Hearts, I'd buy Kingdom fucking Hearts. God damn it!
I can't believe you're saying that you actually fucking did that. You threw away a video game.
I bought it day one! The only other time I've been this angry at day one is Final Fantasy XIII.
Oh, the remake's fantastic. It's my favorite game from the previous generation. So,
I mean,
I love that game.
Look, I get
I fucking
that.
Love that game.
Good. I've seen cutscenes. It looks amazing. But
yeah,
I was sold. I feel like it was disingenuous marketing. I was sold a remake, not a remake of the timeline with Kingdom Hearts multi-universe shit. I was sold a remake of the game.
Look, dude.
Not a remake of the timeline.
I said this in fucking 2015. Don't go listen to this on the Retro Hangover podcast. Don't do this. Don't listen to our show.
But you should listen to Retro Hangover. It's awesome.
But do listen to our show, please. Don't look at the 2015 version. This is what I said then, is everyone wanted the remake of Final Fantasy VII. I said, be careful what you fucking wish for. Because I was one of those, it's going to be a bunch of microtransactions, they're going to milk the shit out of it, and they are.
They are.
But, then not a lot of microtransactions, so give them that. I don't know how they managed to not to do that, but good for them. But, be careful what you fucking wish for, man. Like, all these people that wanted it remade for so long, like, oh, we want a remake. Okay, you got your remake, and you're like, why did they remake it? They remade everything because you wanted it remade.
No, no, Chris, we didn't want a remake of the timeline.
You don't know what you want. You don't know what you want.
Multi-universe. No, I know what I want. I want a remake.
You got what you asked for. You got a remake.
That is what I asked for. That is what was advertised to me. This is the remake.
Sakaguchi's no longer there.
Game. And then
Sakaguchi
he was like,
left.
Oh, actually,
Sakaguchi left.
Actually, it's a play on words. This is Final Seven remake where Sephiroth is trying to fucking remake the timeline. No. That's a bait and switch, motherfucker. And I get it. Like, if you're into that shit, be careful what you wish for. I get it. Be careful what you wish for.
You got, in your case, it was a monkey paw. In my case, it was fucking like a genie rub. So I love it. I fucking love it. I think the remake's better than the original. Sorry. I love it.
It might be because I've never
it's played so it. Fucking good.
But
so fucking
I will,
good.
Actually, I've decided I will play the remake when all three yeah. parts are out and they sell like the definitive version of all three together in one. I will get over my anger and I'll replay it, but not until then.
No, I think the remake has definite. I'm very, very worried that the Final Fantasy VII remake trilogy or whatever it's going to be is some very serious Matrix vibes.
That's already. I mean,
what I mean by Matrix vibes is that the first one's really good. And then over time, it's like,
okay,
fuck did you do? That's why I'm saying Matrix vibes.
Okay, that's I can see that too. I mean, I don't know. They made a lot of money with the first.
Well, you didn't like the first one. Yeah.
I didn't like the first one, obviously. I played maybe.
I loved it.
I'll take this back. I started getting angry at that first alleyway scene with Sephiroth, and it started dawning on me that remake meant like remake of the timeline, not actual remake. But it wasn't until I met that like redhead soldier guy on a motorcycle that wasn't in the first one.
Yeah, it's a weird. I didn't care about
that. I was just like, okay, this is not what you advertised to me, and fuck you.
Well, they were trying to take an 8-hour part of a 40-hour game and make it to a 40-hour game. So they had to add stupid shit.
No, they didn't have to add anything. They could have just... Dude, they're already doing Before... What's it called? Before Crisis or Ever Crisis, which is the mobile version of the entire Final Fantasy VII timeline. That's like a more actual remake.
I don't care. It's all trash.
Yeah, that is trash too. But like, at least me, you know, maybe I didn't pay attention to the marketing enough. Maybe they hinted at it. Maybe I had rosy colored.
No, they didn't. Okay. It's like the Metal Gear Solid 2 deal.
There, but that didn't bother me. I don't know why, but that didn't bother me.
Same thing.
It pissed off a lot of people, though, to be fair.
It did. And I was one of those people who was pissed.
So we're like,
there we go.
We're like opposites on these. Yeah.
Yeah, we are. We are.
Either way, I will play the remake, and I think I do want to see what they do with it, and I will replay it. But yeah, I was so angry at that game, because I was so excited for it. I got, like I said, I got so emotional at the opening scene. The theme comes on, and they remake that iconic intro with the train. Cloud jumps off the train. What I do think they nailed all the characters in the modern, like with graphical fidelity and aesthetic and the art direction, nailed it. Nailed
and personality
it.
Personality-wise.
Like, yeah. They crushed it.
Yeah.
But then it's like, so they did everything right. And I'm like, this is the greatest shit I've ever played in my life. I was so stoked for the first hour and a half, 2 hours, whatever it was. And when it slowly dawned on me that this is some Kingdom Hearts multiverse time travel, it's kind of not quite, I just started getting, it's like, you were so close. You were so close to just remaking the game. But you had to go and, like, I stopped playing Kingdom Hearts for a reason. Because it's batshit crazy. It's you can't even follow it. I've watched 4-hour videos of Kingdom Hearts, and I still don't get it. People trying to explain, like, I don't get it. Why you got to do this to Final Fantasy VII?
I think it's because it would be very, very difficult to make it, remake it like step by step all the way from after Midgard to the end. Like that's a difficult task, but.
And what I don't like is the subtitle for the new one is called Rebirth, which is like, I think they're going to stray even more.
And the
more.
Third one's going to be Reunion.
It better be Reunion. That would be cool. I mean, I guess it would be thematically at least accurate. Either way, so that's Final Fantasy VII. There's nothing really else that I wanted to bring up. I really, really enjoyed it. I don't know if it's recency bias. It's the last, so I played 8 first, 9 second, 7 third. It might be recency.
So are we not going to talk about like the materia system and the gameplay or anything like
we
that?
We should. It is the best. I like the materia system way more than the goddamn crystal ability system of 9. Spoiler alert.
Ooh, I disagree.
Spoiler alert. I didn't like 9 at all. Like, in fact, I had a hard time finishing it. I did not like the game, which is weird because the first time I played it, I liked it a lot. I thought it was like, yeah, it was good. Maybe not my favorite, but I thought it was good. Replaying it as an adult, man, I did not like it. I don't know. I kind of know why, and we'll get into it. But part of the reasons why I thought this ability system, well, 1 in 9, and I wouldn't have known this unless I was using this. Again, I used the strategy guide for all three because I wanted to make sure that I saw all the content. I didn't miss anything. And I was like, okay, I'm not going to figure this out on my own. I don't have time to play this game 7 times. Right? So I'm going to use a strategy guide. I'm going to make sure I don't miss anything. I experience all the content in the game. I would have never known, unless I was using a strategy guide, that 9's leveling system is based on the equipment that you're wearing at the time you get a level up. And your stats are based on the equipment you're wearing. So actually, what you want to do in 9, if you have better stats, is you want to be as low level as you can until you get to the final disc when you have the best equipment, because then you get the best stat bonuses on your equipment. Combined,
I didn't know that,
with you have to keep switching equipment to get ability to unlock abilities. And I found that to be so incredibly tedious. And then I also found I ended up unlocking all the abilities for everybody.
Did we just shift to Final Fantasy IX,
by the way? No, but we're talking about Materia. And I found that, like, not only was it tedious, but I didn't get rewarded for the effort. Whereas in Final Fantasy VII, mastering your Materia is tedious. Like, you got to do a lot of grinding. But then you can take the mastered Materia and you go to Bugenhan's Observatory and you can get Master Summon. You can get Master Magic. You get rewarded for all that effort with, like, better shit. And it's like, okay, it was worth the effort. 9, it was like, okay, you got all the abilities. None of them, other than auto haste and auto regain, the rest of them are dog shit. And they're not even that useful. And it just felt like, so back to what you were saying, I think out of...
We'll get there when we get there.
We'll get there when we get there. But I loved the Materia system in 7. I thought it was... I mean, it's a little open-ended, like, each character can kind of be whatever you want them. There's no, like, designated healer or black mage.
Yeah, which is good or bad, depending on how you view it.
Yes. I liked it because I could kind of... So I know my favorite characters, Vincent and Cid and Cloud. Those are my favorite characters. So Vincent, I was like, okay, he's dark. I want him to be my black mage, like my magic caster. So I kitted him out, and I could make the characters fit how I interpreted those characters' personalities and how, what kind of class or role I think they should make. And it gives you the freedom to sort of craft each character the way you think that character should be, which means if you disagree with me, if you think Vincent is better as a summoner or whatever, you can make him that way, right?
Sure. It's
whatever you want. So I like that about it. And I also like that all the hard effort to beating Emerald Weapon, to beating Ruben Weapon, to getting a gold Chocobo, which is a goddamn pain in the ass, even with the...
Not really.
Even with the strategy guide, it's still tedious.
I got mine in under an hour.
Yep. It's still just... I got mine in like 2 hours, and I followed a strategy guide.
I mean, if you're really trying to do it organically, getting a golden Chocobo takes about forever. But there are some glitches with the game.
You get Knights of the Round, which is like the best summon. I just felt like 7 rewarded you. Yep. Like, you know, when you do the battle arena... You get Omni Slash and like a Protect Ring. You get some really good equipment.
Yes.
I feel like you got rewarded for all the extra stuff. Whereas 9, I beat Ozma and I got like whatever crystal, dark matter crystal that I didn't already had a bunch of them. I don't know. I just felt...
And I'll get to 9. I have my disagreements with what you're saying. And I have to say that. Like, there's a lot of disagreements with that.
Okay. Well,
where you're coming
we're
from.
Talking, I'm talking about 7 and just comparing it to 9, why I like 7.
I got it.
And now this is an unpopular opinion. I like the junction system of 8 almost as much as 7's Materia system. But that's after playing 8 3 times and hating it, and then actually playing through 8 with the strategy guide, and then when I really wrapped my mind around how the system works, then I liked it. It's just like the barrier to entry is so high for that system.
Spoiler, I think the junction system is the best out of the three.
Really?
And not even by a little bit.
I didn't expect that.
Oh, there you go. You got it.
Well, so 7, I would say system-wise, battles are kind of the same on all of them, right? It's either turn-based or ATB-based. Actually, all of them are ATB-based on the PlayStation, right? None of them are turn-based. 10 is turn-based.
They're all ATB.
They're all ATB on the PlayStation. So that's the same. So they really, it really just comes down to abilities and magic. And
yeah,
I liked Seven's Materia Junction System. I like 50-50, almost the same. And then I didn't like Nine System at all.
Okay, so here's what bothers me about the Materia system, is that you are under constant pressure to level up all Materia. So you can, if you have forward knowledge and you're following a strategy guide and you're doing all the things, you can custom tailor your characters to be like, hey, one's an attacker, one is a white mage, one's a black mage. But the way the game actually encourages you to level up Materia in order to get the master Materia, or just keep your Materia current, or whatever you might, however you want to define that, is that you're just going to constantly throw Materia on your characters as it is necessary. Not to mention that a lot of the Materia that makes it like useful or cool, because you don't have armor. I mean, you do have accessories, but you don't really have armor in the traditional sense that you had before this, is you're going to have to use a lot of Materia that you don't commonly find, like elemental, to strap onto your characters in order to absorb or in order to attack with. And now I understand that's just something you get with RPGs in general, and that kind of makes a return to Final Fantasy VIII again, except you have a little bit more flexibility. And another problem is that, like, you can't cast magic on everybody unless, like, the all materia. The all materia is like, what the fuck is this? Because that did not exist up until Final Fantasy VII. I think Final Fantasy VIII is very similar. I can't remember if you can cast it on everybody or not, but
you can.
I mean, the problem with Final Fantasy VIII is, who knows what it's like to cast magic anyway, right? Because you're not doing it. But when it comes to, like, Final Fantasy VII, that's kind of my problem with the Materia, is that it removes any sort of inclination of individuality from your characters. So,
and that's good or bad, depending on taste.
I think it's horrible. I think it's horrible from a Final Fantasy perspective. Now, you might be like, why do I like the Junction system much? Because all the characters in Final Fantasy VIII are just, they're fucking saltine crackers or wafers. They're fucking church wafers. They have no personality. They suck. And we'll get to that. But like in Final Fantasy VII, they have a little bit of personality. So like you might be inclined to try and use different characters, but Final Fantasy VII keeps on trying to drive you to the characters with the best limit breaks, which are Cloud, Barrett, and Cid. Because everyone else's level 4 limit breaks pales in comparison to what those three characters can provide. So you might as well make sure that those three characters have the best setup in terms of Materia, which isn't hard to accomplish once you know what you're supposed to do. And that's just strap on summons, and then once you get a new summon, replace the summon. And then just everyone is like customizable. I get it. And they can have different things, but you don't really have to worry about any of your other characters. And you just have to strap on Materia, and you don't really have to worry about if you lose strength or hit points. There's all the down effects to Materia that's supposed to be there. It's kind of just benign. You don't have to worry about anything. You're like, well, if you master Materia, well, the only way you're going to fucking master Materia is if you have all Materia on all the characters. And you can't really specialize in that sense unless you take a huge HP hit. And I will say, I just said like the degradation doesn't matter too much, but if you overload a character with nothing but magic green Materia and that's all they got, you're going to take a huge HP or MP hit. It's inevitable. Like, everything, like, especially if you're using bigger and badder Materia. So, like, you have to balance it out so you have a balanced party. And it encourages you to focus on limit breaks. It encourages you to focus on summons. There's not really too much of a strategy. It's not bad.
I would agree that your
focus it's like
limit breaks and summons are the main offensive stuff, and
yeah,
and magic is more supportive. I would agree with that.
Yeah, I like on my replay, I don't remember using magic all too much unless the game called for it. Now, by the way, I don't want to make it, I know I sound like very, very cynical here. I think it's fine. I think Final Fantasy VII is fine. But out of the three games on the PlayStation, it's probably my least favorite. Now, I'm not saying it's bad. I'm not saying I don't like it. All I'm saying is my least favorite. I appreciate the Materia system. It feels like a more developed system of what they were trying to do with Final Fantasy VI. Where every character could learn every spell permanently, which kind of broke the game. They're like, okay, we don't want to do that. So how do we prevent that while still, you know, giving customization to the character, to the player? And that's kind of the compromise they came up with Final Fantasy VII. I think it's a good compromise. I think the Materia system is better than the Esper system of Final Fantasy VI. I don't think that Final Fantasy VII is a better overall product in Final Fantasy VI. I think the gameplay is slightly better. I think the plot is significantly worse, but I think like that's why the gameplay is a little bit better, because the Materia system is a more actualized and realized version of what they're trying to do in six with the Espers.
That's a fair point. I guess I just, it didn't bother me as much that magic took a backseat, both when I originally played it and I played it recently, because I think the limit breaks are cool. And I think the summons are cool. I mean, the first time I played Final Fantasy VII, some besides the CGI cutscenes, summons were some of the biggest rewards as you progress through the game. Getting a new summon materia, you get to use it, and you watch this crazy badass summon animation at the time in 1990, whenever it came out, were like mind-blowing. Even now in hindsight, playing it again, I had all these cool mods that make the textures better and 60 FPS. I found the summon animations still enjoyable. I still watched them and still enjoyed them every time I used them. But I would even say summons towards the end of the game became kind of worthless besides Knights of the Round.
And really, yeah, I agree.
It really just became like kitting out your materia with the right kind of stat maximization and your limit breaks. Like once I got double cut, maxed out to 4x cut for, I had three of them and all three of my characters had 4x cut, the game just, you just crush at that point. You don't need magic. Yeah. You don't need summons. You don't need shit.
No, I agree. Like it got to a point where, well, Hades is nice too in certain areas.
Cause the status kind of just, that's the only way I beat Ruby Weapon, by the way, is cause Hades cast Paralyze. And yeah, that's the only way. I would have actually never figured that out. Again, strategy guide. I never beat Ruby Weapon or Emerald Weapon as a kid. I tried and failed and gave up. And I will say this. I messaged you trying to beat Ruby Weapon one night, and I was so fucking frustrated because I was following this guide on how to beat him. But even then, when you do everything right, there's still an element of luck depending on what Ruby decides to do in between certain turns. And if the luck goes the wrong way, you're fucked, and you have to start all over again. And Hades is definitely a part of that because, you know, for those that don't know, Hades basically, it doesn't attack that hard, but it sets all these different status ailments. And it's 100% if the enemy is vulnerable to that status ailment, it's going to hit.
Yeah. We've been talking about Final Fantasy VII for a very, very, very long time. So I think, I mean, we kind of glossed over the gameplay, but like you said, like all the gameplay for all this, other than the actual systems, are the same.
Yes.
Is it time to go to eight?
Let's go to eight. So I would say this, eight for a long time, and even on your podcast when I've been a guest, for a long time, I mean, I'm talking 15 years. I said eight was my favorite of the three.
Okay.
Eight was my favorite for the three because it was the only one that I played through multiple times. I played, like I mentioned before, I played seven once when it came out. I got into the extended universe, but I never replayed 7 until just recently. I played 9 once when it came out. I never replayed it again until just recently. But 8, I played 4 times, the 5th time being recently. I don't know necessarily why for some reason, because when I first played 8, like I mentioned earlier, my brother was so angry when 8 came out, he never played a Final Fantasy again. I was expecting another, like a Final Fantasy 7 2. And I remember, which game was it when there was a game that had a Final Fantasy VIII demo on it that came out? Was it Urgeats or maybe it was Tobal?
Brave Fencer Musashi.
I was at a friend's house that had the demo, and the demo has the initial seed mission when you storm the town and you fight the
robot. It has a different music track too. Yeah, it's pretty cool.
And I saw that, and the first thing I liked was that you didn't have chibi characters in the field.
Yep.
Like the character models were consistent between battle and field, which I thought was a major plus, because even when Final Fantasy VII Verse came out, I didn't like that like your battle models looked so awesome, and then during the rest of the game you had these like weird chibi blocky models, which is probably why I enjoyed my second playthrough, because I modded that shit out and I had right. But eight,
what the fuck is wrong with you?
Because mods are awesome, and the community behind mods are awesome. Dude, I should show you some of the footage I have of 7. It's like
I don't want to play. I don't want to play outside the battles. I like my chibi Final Fantasy 7 members.
They can suck
the fuck is no.
They can suck a dick.
If you're going to play it, play it.
This is something that I was going to say. I'm actually going to say, so I'm going to condense this whole podcast and use for YouTube content. And one of the things I forgot to bring up with Final Fantasy VII was I thought the story scenes were more impactful because the characters, when I played modded, were not chibi. When Aeris dies and she's not a stupid chibi model and Cloud's carrying her into the freaking the ancient whatever pond, and they're not these chibi models, I thought it was more impactful.
Okay.
I mean, you may disagree, but you've never played it.
It's well, funny. Then don't come to me. Okay, look.
If you're going to mod the fuck. I've played it your way. You've never played it my way.
I get that. But if you're going to mod the fuck out of a game, don't like put it on any sort of fucking pedestal because you're not playing the fucking game anymore.
I already said this at the beginning. Take it with a grain of salt.
I know you did.
I played a modded version. God damn it.
But that ruins your interpretation of how these games are supposed to be.
I agree. And I
so don't come here.
I already admitted to it.
Okay, fine. You did.
I've already, disclaimer, I played a modded version. And the modded version is better.
I know you did. But don't be like, yeah, this is Final Fantasy VII is better than all three of them because I played it modded. Well, No. Come on now.
Guess what? Did I say Final Fantasy VII was better or did I say
We're not there yet. We're not there yet. Okay, or did but I, I'm just going to say.
Listen, Linda, listen. Or did I say.
Linda.
You know that viral video? Linda, listen. Anyway, whatever.
Yes.
I'm drunk as shit. It's awesome. I said I enjoyed Final Fantasy VII more. I did not say it was better. I'm not claiming it is objectively better. I'm saying I found it interesting that I enjoyed it the most. I did not expect that because leading into eight is historically, I have gone out of my way to play the devil's advocate and defend eight, not just on your podcast, but many other podcasts I've been guests on. I've been defending eight for a decade. I still think it's better than nine, but when I replayed it, I'll just say this. When I replayed it recently, I was like, ooh, I kind of see why people fucking hate this game. It's got some problems.
Yeah.
It's got some problems.
Some big problems.
So let's get into it.
What are we getting? Where do I start?
Okay, well, I'll tell you what I like.
Positives?
I was kind of already getting into it before I got distracted. What I do like about 8, you don't have to mod it to have consistent battle models and field models. I liked the art direction more in 8 than I did 7, and I still like the art direction. Well, it's hard to say because again,
8 looks the best out of the three.
I would say agreed. I'd say overall, in general, 8 has the best art direction. I even think 8's CGI is better than 9's, and I played both of them back to back. I thought again, 9 has 9 yeah. 9 has almost like a Pixar kind of aesthetic it's going for.
Like in terms of picture quality, in terms of actual cinematography quality, I think 9 is better than 8. But I think in terms of how it meshes with the worlds and how it, like the overall direction with it, I would say 8's probably better.
And I will say one thing that I loved about 8 is, you know, they did a couple things in Final Fantasy VII. For example, when you are in Fort Junon and you ride the elevator and you transition to like a CGI cutscene when the elevator goes up and it seems he transitions into a new pre-rendered background. 8 did that a lot.
I hated that.
The most big – you hated it?
Yeah.
Really? Because there's that scene when
– the game down.
Dude, the garden battle when you're running and the background is a CGI FMV and everyone's – that was like, whoa, baby.
Okay. Look, there's some differences here. I hated it when it was about the mundane shit.
Okay.
Like, I'm on an elevator in Fisherman's Horizon, which I don't think was CG, but Final Fantasy VIII did that a lot, which is, we are going to try and demonstrate how well we can make this game look by animating the shit out of everything and making you wait for it.
That's a fair point.
Now, in terms of, like, you want to talk about like stuff going on in the background, like FMV in the background, and you're running in the foreground with your characters and you're going around in FMV environments and all these things are happening and that. And yeah, like, wow. Like that's some of the most mind blowing scenes when this game came out in 1999. Just like, oh my God, I'm doing this. This is incredible. This is really fucking cool. But when you're doing it, when like nothing's going on and just like, doesn't this look cool? Like, yeah. In when I was a kid, it did. But now as an adult, I'm like, can I just get to the next fucking screen, please? Please. I just want to like,
that's a fair point. The next Again, thing, this is like, my,
all your animations are fucking tedious.
This is my pitch for modding in PC because I just used that fast forward button, dude. I just used that fast forward button. Solve all those problems. This is why, you got to join the, why don't you have a PC and why don't you join the dark side and play some of these games with mods? Why you got to be such, I respect it. You play stuff the OG way. It was originally, I get it, but do you want to enjoy your gaming experience more? Because you can do that. You can mod a game and get more enjoyment out of it.
Okay. I know this is a tangent. This is technically a tangent. But what I will say is like, when I am discussing a game, whatever that game might be, I want to make sure that when I am discussing a game, I want to experience that game for what it was designed to be when it came out. Mods make games more enjoyable. I'm not going to sit here and tell you no. But if I'm going to give you my opinion on a game, I have to look at how the game is, not how people make it to be, because now it's a fabrication of a memory. Now it's a fabrication of an experience. It's making it be something that it's not. And yeah, you can enjoy that more, but people could be like, okay, what's better in terms of design, in terms of overall aesthetics, and in terms of gameplay? And if I'm playing with a mod, I can't make that argument for that experience. All I can say is, if you mod it, it's not a genuine thing. It's like a woman with fake tits, man. Like, we all love fake tits. Well, maybe not. But like, if I see a woman with natural tits and I see a woman with fake tits, I know someone's going to say massage. I don't care. I will say this. Like, I can tell the difference, and I appreciate a woman in a more natural physical condition as opposed to fake tits. And I'm not saying I hate fake tits. I'm not saying I hate body augmentations. What I'm saying is like, this is the original. This is the new thing, and you can enjoy the new thing, but there's always something special about the original that you can appreciate, or you can kind of evaluate. And please don't evaluate women just because they have fake tits or natural tits and say one's better than the other. They're human beings. Please don't do that. I just want to point that out. We're talking about video games. Holy shit. I don't want to get that misconstrued. What I'm saying is like, sometimes the augmentations, yeah, I mean, they can make things better, but it's not the original. And I always want to say, like, if I'm talking about something in terms of like evaluating it or reviewing it or criticizing it, I want to be able to speak to the original experience, because then when I'm talking with somebody who's like, this game is really good, and they're not talking about the original experience, then we're talking about different things.
Okay. I agree with you. And that's why I was very careful at the beginning to say all three games, 7, 8, 9, I played modded to shit and back. But my channel, especially my social media content, has evolved to like, that's what I feature all the time. Is like, if you want to replay these games, but you want to play them with some fresh, you know, perspective, make them a little bit different, you can mod them, and here are the coolest mods, and you can have better visuals. And it's not to say that these, you know, and I'm not saying that certain games are better than not, but what I am saying is, if you want to replay Final Fantasy VII and have a more enjoyable time, this is how you can do it. And you can have a grand old time.
Sure. Sure. But like we ever said, I'm more of an originalist. I want to have that original artistic expression as it was originally expressed. And so I can judge it on its own merits.
So I think the difference is, it's like, you're more honest about how a game was originally.
Yeah.
I'm more interested in how can a game be now?
Sure.
Like, because I've already played Final Fantasy 7, 8, and 9 raw and original. Yeah. I want to play them again, but I want some more variety in my life. I want to play them with some differences. And like, what can you do?
I'm not married to them. Yeah, I play different games.
I do that too. But, you know, again, that's what, like, it's, you're right in the sense, if you're going to objectively say, I'm going to critique game A versus B and C, You have to do it the way you're saying, because mods are not consistent. Final Fantasy VII is great because it's so popular. It has the most options when it comes to mods. It has the most options. Mm-hmm. It's the most popular. Final Fantasy IX was great because it's the easiest to mod. It's a one-click Memoria mod. You push it, you click it, it's done. No troubleshooting. Right. There's different reasons. So you can't bring mods into, like, if you were doing an objective, I'm going to compare 7, 8, and 9 and have, like, a really technical breakdown of what game you think is better. But I'm more interested in, you know, gaming memories is more about, like, how can you relive?
There's the name. He said it.
Yeah. How can you relive these memories in nostalgia?
Yeah.
But without all the shit, because I, again, as an adult, like you said with Final Fantasy VIII, there are these tedious animations and it slows the game down. I don't fucking have time for that. So thank God the official version on Steam has a speed. You don't have to mod it. The official version on Steam has a speed toggle. 2X,
right.
2, 4, and 8. So you could argue, you know, the official remasters kind of exist in a gray area because they're like mods, but they're official re-releases. So that's what I'm more interested in. That's why I wanted to bring you on, because I knew that I played all three of these modded and you played all three of them original. And I want people to know the difference. So you're right. I didn't run into that issue with Final Fantasy VIII this recent time because I had mods. But if you are thinking about playing Final Fantasy VIII and you're going to play at OG status, you got to listen to what Chris is saying. There's like really tedious. All of these old games are slow. By today's, they're all slow.
Which is really weird. The reason they're weird is because they want to show you how much they can do with their visual presentation.
Yes.
It's not because they have to be slow. It's because they want to be cool. That's
exactly.
Why.
Exactly.
That's the only reason. And it's that, and that's a thing of the times. Like that's what they were doing at that time. And that's why I think it's kind of a snapshot. That's why I do this. So I can be like, oh wow, we were dumb.
In many ways. Yeah.
Yeah.
Visuals, I mean, graphics still mattered, but they mattered more back then.
Yes. And what you could do with the hardware, how much you could push the hardware was more important. I think Final Fantasy VII really made that impact more than any other game, much to like the genre's detriment with RPGs. Like now spells had to be more explosive. Now movies had to be longer. Now environmental set pieces had to be more impressive. And that you get a lot more of that in Final Fantasy VIII than you do with IX. And I mean, that's not my biggest complaint because I kind of understand that was something you just had to do with Final Fantasy VIII, but it is a complaint nonetheless. There are times where I'm just trying to go back into Fisherman's Rise and come out or other places where you got to go through a bunch of screens and it's a problem. And in fact, that's not even a problem with the animation. Like a lot of the screens for your cities are just, they're too big for what's being offered.
And yeah, Final Fantasy. True. And I will admit that I played all of these games because again, I'm an adult. I'm trying to get through the game and experience it, but also and get all the footage I need for YouTube content. But I also try to get through it as fast as I can. I don't want to spend 80 hours going through the game. I got through Final Fantasy VIII in like 16 hours. It was fast.
I can believe it.
It was fast.
My biggest problem with Final Fantasy VIII is the plot.
Okay, so we're going to get into that. So I think let's talk about what we like, which we already mentioned, the art direction we liked. We've both touched on that we both enjoyed the junctioning system. I will say this.
Love it.
The first two times I played Final Fantasy VIII, I was maybe too young and too dumb. Well, 100%. I've always been dumb. And when I was young, I was even dumber. I did not get the junctioning system. And I got all the way to disc 3, when you get Ragnarok, the ship, and you come back from space, and I had not used the junctioning. I was not using the junctioning system appropriately. I had grinded and gotten levels, but I didn't have things junction, so I wasn't getting the stat bonuses, and I could not beat the game because my characters just like got their ass kicked, and I gave up. It wasn't until I played the game later and I understood the junctioning system. Then I fell in love with it. So what I will say, I do love the junctioning system, but at least for a 15, 16-year-old version of me, it wasn't explained enough for me to, the first time I played it, for me to understand it in a way to use it correctly. I had to come back as an older person and have the benefit of the internet and have the benefit of YouTube to understand how that system works. So that's the flaw I think the system has, is the game in and of itself doesn't teach you enough about the system. Well, for a teenager, yes. It doesn't teach you enough.
No, you're 100% correct. Yes.
But the system is great if you understand
yes.
it.
Everything you're saying, I 100% agree with. Like, there's so much that the game doesn't directly tell you. It indirectly suggests that you should be doing. It indirectly tells you what you should be doing, but it doesn't overtly tell you what you should be doing. So if you're playing this game correctly, in quotations, you are trying to avoid leveling up at all costs.
Yes.
You're trying to keep your levels as low as possible. You're trying to avoid encounters.
Which is so counterintuitive if you've been playing yeah. JRPGs.
Very counterintuitive. And the game almost encourages you to fight because it keeps giving you encounters. So, you know, what do you do? And or if you're turning your enemies into cards. So, like, the point is to keep your levels low, but somehow get the best spells in the game, which is entirely possible. Because when I beat the game just like a few months ago, I was at level 23. And the only reason I was even that high is because I screwed up and killed some monsters I didn't want to kill at Esther, one of the last cities that you go to once, you know, a certain event happens and you can encounter monsters in the city. At that point, like, I was at level 19, 20. I could have beat that game at level 19. And that's what I love about the Junction system. That's why it's my favorite of all the PS1 games. It might be one of my favorite in all of Final Fantasy. It's because of how you can exploit it. Yes. And how you can learn to exploit it. And yes, it takes work to exploit it. It's just not, you can just do this easily. You have to understand the systems.
But it rewards you for doing that work.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. You're going to put time into it. It's not just like this get rich quick scheme. I mean, if you exactly know what you're supposed to do, it is, but like, you got to play some triple triad. You've got to level up your guardian forces. You have to be able to get abilities that allow you to exploit what you're doing in terms of everything that you're trying to accomplish, and being able to balance all your characters, getting the right spells to attach to the junction system. That's all part of exploiting this game. And it's beautiful. It's so much fun because there aren't that many games that teach you to avoid combat and yet reward you with power for it. And that's what Final Fantasy VIII does in spades. Its gameplay cycle, once you accept what it actually wants you to do, not what it tells you you should do, it's amazing. Yes, you still do have to draw. The draw system is tedious and stupid and boring. You have to do that occasionally. But once you learn, you can get pretty much any spell in the game from the items in your inventory, and how you harvest those items in that inventory through the card system, it becomes an entirely different game.
Exactly.
It becomes a better game.
There's a really good YouTube video. I wish I could remember the creator's name. I'll put it in the description. I'll look it up later and post.
Yeah.
But there's a guy, I forget his name, but he has a series of videos of like how powerful you can get early game in RPGs. Yeah. And so he has a video of how powerful you can get before you even get Ifrit. Yep, the first dungeon.
It's entirely possible.
And he spends like eight, like you said, it takes time. He puts like 80 hours into like farming items and doing cards.
No, you can't do that before Ifrit. Now,
maybe it's after Ifrit. I can't remember. It's like ridiculously early in the game. Again, I'll find a link to this video and I'll put it in the podcast description. I might be misquoting the details, but the gist is, the spirit of the video is, it's like some early point in the game, either before or after Ifrit. It's definitely before you go to the town with like the train and the clocks and you meet Rinoa.
Because you get Quetzalcoatl is your first.
You get Quetzalcoatl and then Ifrit. Those are the I think you have those two.
Yep.
Anyway, it's something along. It's like the point of the video is how powerful can you get early game? And I forget the point he put as like the threshold of early game, but he gets like game breaking powerful, like right at the beginning of the game, like definitely disc one, probably the first half of disc one. But he also says it took me like 60, 70 hours to get to this. But you can exploit the system and do that. And like you said, it's all with cards and items.
Yes. It can be difficult, but it's extremely, extremely rewarding. And you can get bored. I got bored too. Triple triad. The thing with Triple Triad too is as you progress through the game, they introduce stupid rules. They don't give them, I don't
the region care rules, for it all. Yeah.
Yeah. Regional rules, but you can get around that. You don't have to play Triple Triad halfway through if you're abusing the game. Cause I stopped playing halfway through because of the stupid rules. But yeah, man, like the other thing is too, is like how your limit breaks are executed is once you learn that too, you find a spell that like aura increases your hit points.
Yeah.
Like by to maximum. And all you got to do is just put that on your character and increase it to maximum. And all of a sudden now you're at low HP. And when you're at low HP, you have a higher likelihood of triggering your limit break. So all you have to do is keep on canceling out your character's item set. And all of a sudden you're doing gangbuster damage with Squall. And on top of that, you can get like Squall's final weapon before the end of disc one. The amount of freedom it gives you in terms of developing your characters. And I still don't like the fact that all of your characters are kind of faceless, you know, just puddles of goo. But what I do like is that you can always have a party that will do exactly what you want them to do and can pretty much conquer everything. And that's why I love the junction system of Final Fantasy VIII. It's an amazing battle system. It's an amazing character customization system. And I think it trumps the shit out of the Materia system.
I don't know if I would say, I would agree that I love the junction system. I'm torn because both of them reward you for exploiting. Like by the time you get to the end of Final Fantasy VII and you have 4X cut and you have master and you have Quasar magic and you have W magic. So the way I beat Emerald Weapon is W magic lets you cast two spells. Right? Yeah. So I have W magic and then I have my master magic attached to Quadra magic and W magic in some other separate spot. Yeah. So I pick W magic, then I would pick a spell that I want, pick it twice, and then it's Quadra magic. So then I'm getting eight casts of that spell. And I, like for Emerald Weapon, because his HP is so high, you can cast Gravity 1. I think it's called just Gravity or Graviga or I had a mod that has modern spell names and now I'm forgetting what it was, but Gravity 1, right. The lowest level version of Gravity, which is a percentage, but because Emerald Weapon's HP is so high, that hits for straight nines. So then I would just cast Quadra Magic twice with W Magic. That's eight casts of Gravity, which is 8, 10,000, so basically 80,000. And then I would have the next character mime that, and the next character mime that. So you get to the point, like, you can exploit the Materia system where it gets crazy and you're so powerful. The junction system is the same way. You can exploit it where you get, like, beyond overpowered. It rewards you for figuring it out.
But it rewards you far earlier than at the end of the game.
I agree. It rewards you way earlier. I agree.
Yes. Like, there's nothing better than being, like, level 5 or level 6. Well, not that low, but like level 10 all throughout of disc 2. Like you're talking 20, 30 hours in the game and you're level 10.
And you're crushing
and
people.
You're defeating bosses with one limit break because you're so fucking powerful.
Yeah.
There's no bigger power fantasy in all of Final Fantasy than that. And it's, I don't care what anyone says. Like you should not. Final Fantasy V probably has some examples. In fact, Final Fantasy V definitely does have some examples of some gross power fantasies and what you could do once you learn to manipulate that system too. But I just feel that like Final Fantasy VIII does it in such a manner because the enemies scale with you that if you know exactly what you're supposed to be doing, nothing is a threat. But the game makes you figure that out.
Yes.
It doesn't handhold you.
Correct.
And I'm a bigger fan of a little bit of handholding, but kind of the way like Final Fantasy VIII says, hey, look, we're giving you all the tools to succeed. You can play this like a regular RPG and still be successful, but we're giving you tools to play this a little bit differently. Go have fun and figure it out. And it doesn't really punish you unless you want to grind. And that's the only way it punishes you, which a lot of people would be like, well, that I'm fucked up. And I was when I first played it too as a kid because I grinded.
That's what I did.
You're not supposed to.
You're not supposed
to. You're definitely not supposed to. You do, you get fucked. That's it.
So we agree the battle system is enjoyable. I think you put it way above 7. I would put it, never talking to you again, because 8 is the first one I played of the 3. and this like recent playthrough. So it's the farthest back in my memory. I think I have, again, I'm trying to, do I have recency bias with 7? Cause it's the most recent one that I played through. I would say, you know, I agree with you. I would say it's apples and oranges. I loved 8 battle system. I love the junction system. Would I agree that it's light years ahead of Materia? I don't know about that, but I could agree it's ahead of the Materia system. I don't know about light years. So we're pretty close.
Okay. If I said light years, I apologize. It's just far, far, far ahead of it. Not light years, but it's far ahead of it.
So now we're going to get into, we've already talked about the art direction is amazing. Now, I separate the plot and the writing with world and the lore because.
Okay.
I think 7 has decent world lore and their writing is kind of in motivations. We got into that.
Shit.
It's shit, but not great. I think 8's world and lore is top tier, but the writing and actual story is also shit, like 7, because a lot of things don't make sense. But just the idea of like you have these mercenary gardens and these mercenaries are for hire, just like sort of the world that they built. And that you have sorcerers and sorceresses, and you have not espers. What are they called in 8? Summons?
Guardian forces.
Guardian forces. Edelon is like the new standard term, but guardian forces.
Edelons. Yeah.
Edelons. Again, I can't pronounce. Is it Edelon or is it Edelon?
Edelons.
Edelon?
Yeah.
Eidilons, whatever it's pronounced.
Yep.
But in 8, they're called guardian forces. I like the lore of them, of finding them, but. So I loved all of that. Like I feel like the world they set up is cool, but then the actual execution and the story, replaying it recently. Again, I defended 8 for years. I was the contrarian because everyone, for the most part, hates 8. It's including, for the most part, 8 gets a lot of hate. Rhyme intended. I would defend it. I would defend it. I would defend it. And I played it through. And aside from the battle system, which we already praised, which I liked, and the graphics and the art, the plot is so bad.
It's horrible.
It's so bad. Like, I think when I was a kid, I was so enamored by the art direction that I kind of just glossed over the plot. Replaying it now as an adult, I'm just like, it's not as bad as 9 as far as the end boss goes, is having like no relation to the whole plot. But
as far as the end boss goes, but you're talking about up until then.
I'm like, so we'll get into 9, but 9 is like, you have this end boss, and at the very end, they're like, hey, here's this brand new major bad guy we've never mentioned, and he's the end boss. Like, fuck you.
We'll get there.
We'll get there. But we'll 8 kind of does the same thing, right? You think it's Edea.
No.
And then they're like, oh, no, by the way, the actual end boss is this sorceress from the future who we never explain why she wants to achieve time compression. And she's just bad because we say she's bad.
No, it's actually worse than that.
Okay.
Because they do explain it and it's bad. So it's just everything about the plot for Final Fantasy VIII is bad. I'll even say like the world building is kind of suspicious. Because can we talk about the fact that these gardens with these seeds are effectively orphan child soldiers that are raised for the specific purpose of going out and killing each other? And there's no problem with this. It's never really mentioned that this is a bad thing. But they said like all seeds are going to be between the ages of 14 and 19. And once they're 20, they can't be seeds anymore. So your entire military mercenary force in this world are children, and it's just kind of humorously talked about. Like in one of the opening scenes, you go to Dalet, and before you go, like Cid's giving you a debrief. And first of all, you have to recognize one, you're all children. I think you're all like 17, 16. I think Quistis is 17. She's like the oldest at 17 or 18.
No, she's a teacher. She's got to be at least 18. Come on.
I know, right?
Also that opening FMV when Christus walks in and she rolls her hair and rolls her eyes when you're in the memory. Yeah. Come on, son. Come
Hot
on.
Hot for teacher. Hot for teacher.
Hot for teacher, baby.
But like Cid comes out and he's like, you're going on a mission that might be dangerous. You might die. Oh no. It's like, you're talking to kids. These are children. They're like, no one made a big deal about this. I'm just blown away. That like you're talking about child soldiers and everyone's like, this is super cool. fine.
That's a good point.
I think it's been handled much better in later media, where it's kind of looked down upon, like, child soldiers are probably a bad thing. Final Fantasy VIII celebrates it.
That's true.
It doesn't provide any criticism of it, and it encourages it and kind of, like, views it as a noble thing. I don't even think that's a Japanese thing, because, like that's an entirely problematic concept in a game that just came out as we're recording it in Xenoblade Chronicles 3. Like, the entire concept of child soldiers and teenagers fighting needlessly is, like, this is horrible. It's, like, glorified as fuck in Final Fantasy VIII. Like, it's very dark, and it doesn't really talk about that. But let's get past that, because as much as a major theme, that's, like, an oversight. It's just, like, fucking bad. But let's get, like, to why it's really bad. And that's, the characters suck. The way the plot is presented is terrible. Like, for Disc 1, it's actually pretty good. I'll give it this. Disc 1 is
okay. It starts out okay. I agree.
Yeah. And that's, like, the entirety of Disc 1. But then you go from Disc 1 to the rest of the game, and it might as well have been written by two different people. And this is why you have all these stupid theories out there that say Squall died at the end of Disc 1. Why? Because the entire temperature, tenor, writing style, character descriptions, world building is entirely different between Disc 2 and 4. And Disc 2 and 4 is really compressed. Like, there's not much that goes on. You just go from town to town to town. There's not much really any of a narrative in Disc 2 through the end. And one is where you establish everything. It's a completely different plot structure and writing style than you get in the remainder of the game.
I've never heard this theory that Squall died. So for me and the audience, can you explain that theory?
So the theory is, and it's been shot down by Katase, which I think is the producer. The thing is at the end of Disc 1, Idea is this queen, like, sorceress.
Oh, when he gets hit with the ice in the chest?
When he gets hit with the ice.
Yes.
And the theory is that he dies there, because the way that the characters behave in Disc 1, and this happens at the end of Disc 1, where he gets hit with this giant ice thing, it goes straight through his chest. And the way that the characters behave in Disc 2, especially towards Squall, is completely different. They are totally uncharacteristic to what they were initially introduced as. Plus, when you go into the beginning of Disc 2, Squall says, I have no wound. What happened to it?
He does say that. I forgot about that.
Now, it's been said, oh, that's just a silly rumor. But, like, you're talking about, like, in the second, like,
I mean, he got impaled through the chest,
yeah,
with the giant ice. Yeah.
Yes. That's, and it goes through him.
It goes right through
all
him.
The way through.
Oh, you see it. Yes.
Yes. And you go from, remember, Rinoa is, like, hot for Safer. And you could tell that they were in love. They had a relationship. They were probably banging. And then all of a sudden, after Squall,
I didn't even pick up on that the most recent playthrough.
Yeah. Like, they had been dating, like, the previous year. Damn. And then you get into the second half, and then Rinoa just completely forgets about Safer. And all of a sudden is hot for Squall. Rinoa hates Squall in Disc 1. And all of a sudden, the garden is controlled by this giant squid person.
Norg. That part.
Norg.
That makes no sense. Yes.
And then it's not talked about for the rest of the game.
The rest of the game. Yes.
The rest of the game. It's not even a shocker. They're like, oh, you're in charge of the garden. You kill him. It's like, okay, that was the thing. And you move on. It's like, wait, what?
But they do mention you find that other town with, like, other Norgs later in the game. Like, the
but they don't even talk about him there. And it's not even mandatory.
It's not mandatory. I agree. So some of these points, I don't disagree with you. I just didn't notice them even on my most recent playthrough. Again, I was blazing through that game as fast as possible because I was trying to get the footage. But when the Norg thing as a kid and even most recently, it's like, oh, there's this guy in the basement of Garden that secretly controls everything. And then you kill him and then you just move on. And they never explain where he came from. And like, what? That for me was the beginning of, like, the WTF moments for this game.
Yeah. And this entire story is supposed to be about a love story between Rinoa and Squall. And I never feel it. It's forced.
It's forced.
It's totally forced. Especially because your party in Disc 2, this is one of the things that you hear behind the theory of why Squall is dead, because everything beyond Disc 2 to the end of the game is the entire world is focused on what what Squall would want to see it turn out as, or everyone's focused on Squall's desires and concerns.
So it's like you're in his afterlife, is the theory that's playing
out?
Yeah,
like you're in a story that's being narrated and written by Squall for Squall.
Mm.
Like, it's just too convenient everything is turning out the way it is for him. Because it shouldn't be turning out the way it was based on the narrative and world building that you have happen in Disc 1.
That kind of makes sense. I've never heard this theory before. But it's making me think, because I do remember thinking, how did he survive?
Yeah.
That initial attack from Idea, because they play Idea up as this like all powerful wizard, or sorceress that nobody can stand up against. And he gets, and for those who haven't played the game, he doesn't get impaled by a tiny piece of ice. I mean, this is like his entire chest, both left and right side, like his whole.
It's just his right side.
It's a big piece of ice though.
Giant piece of
ice. It's a giant piece of ice that goes straight through him.
All the way through him.
You see it from front to back, and he falls off this parade. What do they call float?
A float.
He falls off a float, and yeah, he just wakes up, and he doesn't even have a scar, they kind of imply. So
no.
How does that work? Even in like the logic of the world, you know, obviously these are fantasy games. They're not based in any sort of reality, but they do set.
But they didn't know what Moombas were.
They didn't, right? Like even in the game's the world building's own logic, it doesn't make sense that he would survive. That's a good point.
Yeah. There's a lot of inconsistencies. You go to I can't remember the specifics, but I remember playing it and I was commenting. I was like, why am I going to space? And like, one of it was because the only place they could help Renoa, or the only place they could cleanse Idea or something, was if you went to space.
I can't remember. Was it to get the
because
ship?
Idea lost her sorcerer powers, and then Renoa got knocked out. And what we learn is that Renoa got sorceress powers. It transferred from Idea over to...
True. You're right. Yes.
Renoa, I can't remember the name of the
ship. She inherited Ultimecia's.
Ultimecia, that's
yeah.
It. She inherited Ultimecia. And so their solution to this, because they say the only place they can solve this is in space, because of course it is.
They're going to trap her in space, yes.
Which... is coincidentally where they have the old sorceress Adele in suspension, like out on another satellite. And it's like, this is so dumb. And so like the end of it is some Final Fantasy 1 shit where they send stuff to the future and to the past. And that's where like it causes like this time loop that compresses time. It's like, I can't remember the specifics. Like when I was reading it, it's like, okay, I understand where they're coming from. This is some Final Fantasy 1 Garland shit where like Garland's in the present and he actually sends himself back into the past. So in the future, the chaos monsters can like destroy the world. It's very similar to the plot of Final Fantasy 1 in my mind. And that's kind of the point of time compression, that you send someone to the past to the future to fight Ultimecia, so they send you to the past so it destroys something, so like everything combines, so you don't have, because essentially Ultimecia is sending yourself back to the past to possess people so they can go into the future and maintain power. Something weird, right?
Right. Like what I remember is Ultimecia is trying to do things in the past which will allow her to achieve time compression in the future. That's the gist of it.
She doesn't want to achieve time compression. You activate time compression in order to defeat Ultimecia.
She wants time compression. That's explicitly stated that she wants time compression.
I thought that you wanted time. I see. This is why this plot's fucked.
This is why the plot is fucked. Yeah.
I thought that you wanted time compression because Ultimecia was spreading herself throughout time by being far in the future and sending herself back to the past in order to create a present which allows the future where she is coming.
Okay, so
from
I just typed in why does Ultimecia, because I remember at the beginning of this conversation, I thought there was no explanation as to why Ultimecia wants to compress time. She's just this bad guy from the future.
Because I thought because you trigger the time compression through Squall's stepsister, who he doesn't bang in a washer, Elena. And that's who triggers the time compression.
This goes, we haven't even touched on the Laguna side.
Oh, Laguna should have been the protagonist, but Laguna's the best character in that fucking game.
He actually has a good arc.
Fantastic.
He has a good arc. Yes.
Oh, he is so good. His entire arc is fantastic. It's tragic. It has personality. It's just like, why am I not him?
Well, you are him for a little bit. And not. also, I think the coolest character in the game is his buddy Kiros that has like the hand, yes, the hand scythes or whatever they're called.
All three of those characters are awesome.
They're all awesome. Like, okay, so this says, cool, as Ultimisia wanted to compress time in order to be omnipotent as a goddess. Yes. From the in-game explanation, Ultimisia, already an extremely powerful sorceress, planned to achieve deity status by absorbing the powers of all sorceresses from the past in the future by compressing time into one singularity. So
yes,
the way I interpreted it as, you do trigger time compression inadvertently by defeating her, and you have that scene where Squall's like on like that little piece of brown.
No, you trigger time compression intentionally so you can fight her because she's in the future.
Aren't you already in time compression when you're in her castle?
Yes. But you trigger time compression so you can go to her castle.
How do you trigger? I don't remember. What do you do to trigger?
I don't remember. Something Elena does after she defeats Saber.
I remember she has something. Elena is something special, right? She has some sort of power that they're trying to get at. But
you intentionally initiate time compression so you can go to Ultimacia's castle.
Okay. That I agree with. What I'm not clear on.
It's still dumb.
It is all. This whole conversation is an illustration of why it's so dumb, because we're two, yes, hardcore nerds and we can't fucking make sense of it. That's all you need to know.
It makes sense when they're telling you it, but I can't remember what they fucking told me.
I do remember Ultimisia wants time compression as well. Maybe you trigger it earlier than she wanted or something like that, but she wants it to become like all sorceresses, yes, combined in one.
Yes.
Either way,
the ending's fucking weird.
Either way, the Laguna thing was cool because Laguna was awesome, but they didn't. I think like Laguna's little self-contained story is amazing, but the way they integrate it into the greater narrative, I think, is botched pretty hard because
it's botched hardcore.
I didn't understand it all. Well, go ahead.
You picked up that Laguna's Squall's father, right?
Yes. Only the last time I played it.
So Laguna is Squall's father. And who's the girl that Laguna was trying to pick up at the beginning of the game?
The piano player girl.
Yeah, that's Renoa's mother.
That's Renoa's mother?
Yes.
I thought that was Squall's mother.
No. Squall's mother is the girl that...
Oh, she's in the town.
She's in the town.
She
gives birth to Squall while Laguna is away. Because they say that Laguna tried to get back with Rain. Rain's her name. Rain is Squall's mother.
Yes, you're correct.
It's funny.
Yeah.
So Rain gives birth to Squall and Laguna. So Lagoon and Rain make a Squall and whatever her name is.
Elena.
She marries the general in the town. Now that Laguna's son and his initial love's daughter are going to hook up, it's like destiny. It's like, this is... I don't care.
It's
this
wild.
So dumb.
Like, again, so I'm not like, this is a perfect illustration is, if you're listening to this, you're like, this doesn't make any sense. It's because it doesn't make any sense.
It makes sense. It's just stupid.
Kind of makes sense. If you've like spent time scouring Reddit threads and watching explainer videos, like all four times I played this I didn't even pick up that Laguna was Squall's father. Again, I'm not the sharpest tool in the shed. So maybe it's there, but it wasn't until this very last time. And again, I was playing through a walkthrough that was kind of explaining these things, and I'm much older now. I have the benefit of hindsight and of being familiar with the game. Some of this started to make a little bit more sense. But again, every time I played this game, we haven't even touched on this. Every time I played this game, the part that makes the absolute most zero sense to me, the biggest plot hole, is the whole like, hey, we were actually all in the same orphanage and we forgot about it.
So bad.
What in the actual fuck was it? Who got paid to write that?
You know what's worse? It's like, I remember it being like, oh, that's rather convenient. So I just remember like, yeah, that's a pretty bad plot point.
Yeah, it's
convenient. Watching it again recently and see it develop, I'm like, this is worse than I remember it.
It's so bad.
Like, it's horrible.
God damn. It's like, wait, you were all from the same orphanages? Well, now their explanation is the use of guardian forces clouds your memory.
Of course it does, right?
But it's like some people, I think it's Irvine. I forget who it was.
Irvine never used a guardian.
He never used one. That's what I was trying to say. There were people that had specifically said, I've never used a guardian force, and you teach them. So why can't he remember that they were all in the same orphanage?
No, he does remember.
Doesn't he say
he's the only one who remembers?
Doesn't he say, I remember, but I didn't say anything about it? Because
yes, I didn't say anything about it because I thought you all knew is what he said. Like, I thought you all knew about it. I just thought it was you didn't say anything about it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay. To be fair, Irvine does okay.
That's why he can't kill Idea in the end of Disc 1, because he's supposed to as a sniper, and he can't take the shot.
Oh. That makes total sense, because she was his, basically, mother.
She was the matron.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. That just clicked for me. But that makes... Okay, so it's not... Some of it makes sense. It's just kind of hard.
No, like I said, it makes sense. It's just stupid.
Yeah, dude, if someone's listening to this and they've never played the game, it would be like, this is worse than the plot of Lost. Like, what the fuck is happening? Oh, my God. Okay, so that brings us towards the end of 8.
Going back, okay, I'll say this about the gameplay. Like, the gameplay... The system is great, but the gameplay is kind of shit because it does kind of rely on luck and RNG in order to get certain items, in order so you can get certain spells and level up certain weapons. It can like it and like Triple Triad being as important as it is in terms of getting those items. Towards the latter part of the game, the latter part of this game is where it fell apart. And that's actually when I was a kid, when I dropped it. Is when I got to like the beginning of Disc 4, because it really does kind of suck at the end of the game. But that's what I'll say. Like the entire plot is always a mess. The gameplay does work, but like all of 8 just kind of falls apart at the end. I have a better opinion of 8 now than I did like even last year, but that's not saying much.
It's interesting because my opinion dropped a little bit. Replaying it, yours went up a little bit. I think we're pretty much in agreement. The system and the game, the system's good. The gameplay is serviceable. The plot is terrible. Yeah. Art direction is great. The only thing we disagree on, I guess, is the world building and the lore.
Yeah.
But you did make a good point about as you were talking about child soldiers, I was thinking about Metal Gear 5 Phantom Pain, which explores child soldiers pretty in depth and the horror of having child soldiers.
And that was cool, according to Final Fantasy VIII.
But then you're right. Final Fantasy VIII doesn't outright celebrate it, but it's one step behind outright celebrating it.
Yeah. Oh, soundtrack's the best in the entire
Final Fantasy. Oh, yes. I'm glad you brought that up. So Blue Fields might be my favorite Final Fantasy song of all time. Minus Prelude and Blue Fields are constantly like kind of battling for number one. But you know, this is something I wanted to bring up, which we'll tie into number 9, and I can edit out our break we're going to have in a second. But I didn't realize how many recurring soundtrack or melody themes are in every game. Like the soundtrack in 9, when you're in the crystal at the end, whatever song that is in every Final Fantasy on PS1. It's always like there's certain themes that are in melodies that are in every single Final Fantasy.
Yeah, there's like two songs, the Prelude and the Final and Final Fantasy. Prelude is in everything. They took Prelude out. I can't remember what game, but like the Final Fantasy theme is in like in every single one. And I think it's not in one of them. I can't remember, but they have certain themes that stick with the games. In every single
and episode. This will lead into Final Fantasy IX. Out of all of them, the only soundtrack that is completely forgettable, minus the themes that are consistent with every Final Fantasy, I can think of multiple tracks from 7 and 8 that I can recall in my mind and enjoy. With 9, I don't remember. And I played 9 the most recent. Like I just played 9 like last month. I can't remember any of the soundtrack. None of it stuck with me.
We'll get to that. I understand where you're coming from that, but we'll definitely get into that.
We discussed Final Fantasy IX on Discord while I was playing it. I had some confusion. We ended with Final Fantasy VIII and talking about the plot and how shitty it was.
It's horrible.
And I agree it's shitty. I'm not 100% sure that Final Fantasy IX's plot is much better for me. It's
much better.
Now, I know you think it's better.
Yeah.
But this idea of, like, what's buried in your subconscious, what are you forgetting about your true nature, plays into Zidane's origin story, right? Zidane has amnesia. He doesn't remember that he came from, is it Terra or Gaia? I forget the two, which one is which.
He's on Gaia.
He's from Gaia, right? Terra,
I think. We'll just go with that. It doesn't matter. He's Goku.
He's Goku, exactly. And he doesn't, you know, the thing that doesn't make sense to me, we're just going right into it. And if you haven't played Final Fantasy IX, this won't make any sense, but most of you will have played it. It was never clear to me why he can't remember his origins. Why can't he remember?
It's just because when he went to wherever he went to, when he went to Gaia, I guess, he completely forgot his mission. He just suffered amnesia.
Why?
But they don't. Because he does.
Because he does, exactly. You know what I mean? So we're talking about plot.
They don't explain like his childhood. They don't explain like his younger years, really.
They don't.
Unless I missed it.
Yeah. I played it again. 8 was the farthest back in time. I played 7 and 9 very recently. I will say this. 9, there were certain things about 9's plot I liked a lot. Like, I loved Vivi's character arc. And I loved how Vivi and Zidane kind of have the same...
They're a parallel arc.
Yeah, they're coming to terms with the same thing. Just Vivi comes to terms with it first, and then Zidane comes to terms with it later, that they're both sort of clones, and, like, what is their purpose?
It's deeper than that, though.
Go ahead.
Final Fantasy IX's plot starts out very, very blandly.
Yes.
Like, it does not start out... Holy shit, you're drinking that straight.
Dude,
you're fucking nuts, man.
I have not drank in 5 months, like not a single drop, and I'm going hard for you.
Yeah, I can tell. At least I mix my shit. That's why I don't. Well, you're drinking. Yeah, there you go. Liquid Death Sprite, Chaser. But it starts out like very early. It just seems like a very typical high fantasy game.
Yes.
And I think that's really mostly the Final Fantasy IX's. I don't know if a detriment or benefit.
Some people would say it's a benefit because the whole you tell me if you remember differently. We were both very into Final Fantasy at this point. When the game was marketed, I remember it being marketed as a return to Final Fantasy roots. The crystals,
yes.
High fantasy. You saw the promotional images and footage of Vivi, who's like a traditional black mage.
Yes.
Looks just like the Final Fantasy I black mage. So a lot of people might think that's better, like this kind of bland general high fantasy, because they were, again, a lot of people were very angry about 8, even though I liked it initially and I still like it. And we both liked the battle system and the junction system, the junction system. But even initially, I liked 8 back in the day when it first came out, when everybody else around me in the gaming media and the gaming magazines all seemed to trash 8. And I think they were reacting to the negative reception to 8. And so they wanted to go back to the roots of what made Final Fantasy special. So a lot of people would say that's a positive.
Like, they have some callbacks too. Like Garnet's sister, Aiko, has a horn.
Yes.
Coming out of her head, which I think they said they removed from
her sister?
Yeah.
Where are you getting that from?
Their sisters.
They never... I just played this game. Where do they say they explicitly are sisters?
Like, it's a big fucking theme.
God damn it. I might...
Are you serious?
I might... You know, like, I can admit I'm wrong as shit. I'm wrong all the time.
They share the same mother.
And who's their mother?
They don't go into that. I mean, they show Garnet's mother at like the opening scene.
So Garnet's...
But yeah, their sister.
The freaking fat, ugly queen is not her biological mother.
No.
That I've picked up on, that they specifically say
yes.
That.
I mean, I might be confusing it with five, but I think Garnet and Aiko are sisters.
Well, obviously other people think that because this person's asking the same question on this forum.
I think it was like pretty implicitly said. If I'm misremembering, I'm misremembering. But like, I think it was like pretty like explicit. Like they are sisters. Cause they're both summoners.
I mean, it is explicitly implied that they have a shared history with being both summoners. Like they're both part of the same tribe is how I interpreted it. But tribe and being actual sisters is kind of, I interpreted it as they're both the same bloodline. They both have the same ancestry, but not that they're specifically sisters.
I don't know why. If I'm wrong, I'm wrong, but I'm remembering it there. That's her sister.
What is the deal with Dagger and Eco? Are they sisters, cousins, friends, etc.? I remember Dr. Tot saying something early disc 3 about them in the horn. What's the deal with all that? When Garnet is in Madame Sari, that's the summoner town for those who are not aware of, in the boat, she remembers how Madame Sari is attacked by the Invincible, which is the flying airship with the giant eye. And that
call back to Final Fantasy 3.
And she and her mother escaped in a boat. Nope, they are members of the same race of summoners, but they are not sisters, according to Ricky Thorpe 7. So, I mean, he's obviously not the producer.
I always thought they were sisters.
They might be. So either way, at the very least, they are part of the same bloodline and tribe. They might be sisters. Yeah, they're related. Yes.
Yeah. But, so there's, I don't know how they even got started.
We talked about the plot with Final Fantasy.
Yeah, it's very tropish. It's very high fantasy. It's very original Final Fantasy. But here's why, like, the plot for me, because even I, for a long time, viewed Final Fantasy IX as a very average RPG. Just because it was very tropish. It makes a lot of callbacks to the other Final Fantasies, which is great if you're a Final Fantasy fan. But I think it's one of those games that if you, like, had not played Final Fantasy, then it's kind of like it's okay kind of RPG. And then it gets to the end of Disc 3, and then all of the plot building it was doing with, like, Vivi as kind of this representation of Zidane and how that all kind of tied together and what Zidane was going through, like, kind of turned the game on its head a little bit. Because there's a lot of shit in Final Fantasy IX that just, it's dumb. Like, the rat girl, I fucking hate her, man. Freya. Like, I fucking hate her. Beatrix is awesome. Beatrix is, like, Steiner has one of the best arcs in any
Steiner
Final Fantasy
Beatrix,
game.
Like, sort of side love story, I did like.
Yeah. Steiner is one of the best characters in terms of development. I hate his design. Oh, my God. Oh.
But
that can be said about...
He does.
Let's not talk about design.
Oh, yeah.
But in terms of, like, a pure character, Steiner is one of the best in any Final Fantasy game. Full stop. He's one of the most developed. He has most personality, has the longest arc, best developed arc out of probably any character in the entire series. Hands down.
He has a good arc where he goes, you know, he's this super loyal knight, and then he has to go through questioning loyalty and blind faith and what is right and wrong. It's a great arc. Yeah, I agree.
But when it comes to the thing about Final Fantasy IX, and this is why I can understand a lot of people not liking the plot, but I can also understand why it's a lot of people's favorite.
It's many Final people's Fantasy. Favorite. It's many people's
many
favorite.
Many people's favorite. It's because it is a character-driven plot. Like, the actual plot itself, the actual overarching plot that's separate from the characters is not very good. I don't think it's very good.
I would agree with you.
But the characters themselves are very endearing, are very well developed, and the characters have a long process that relates to each other and interacts with each other and chains with each other with a beginning and middle of an end. Probably the closest thing I could say would be Final Fantasy VI. And you could argue it does it better than Final Fantasy VI. I would say with the sheer amount of characters you have in VI, I think VI does a much better job, especially with the hardware limitations. But in terms of just, like, objectively speaking, from what you have in terms of raw material side by side, you know, no context provided, 9 probably does it better than any other game. I think that's why people love it as much as they do.
I agree.
It's because every character has something that you can attach to, and how Zidane, your main protagonist, goes from this happy-go-lucky, don't worry about it, everything's going to be okay, until he comes to the realization that, you know, that burden that Vivi was dealing with is now his burden and he can't accept it, until his friends tell him it's okay. Because he's been kind of like the motivational person. He's the one that's always bringing.
He's carried everybody. Yes. He's
carried everybody with him. And then when finally his entire world collapses, he finally realizes that he needs other people to carry him too, which is something he didn't allow. Which is an incredible character.
I would say this. We talked about this on Discord, but yeah. Out of all three games, even though I liked Final Fantasy IX the least as a whole, the most emotional scene out of all three of them was when Zidane escapes from the prison on the Invincible. And he's like, he's all downtrodden about learning his true nature and that he's a clone. And you have to do a boss fight with every character. So yeah. Like you go through, you fight a fight and it's like Freya's there helping you. And then the next fight is Vivi's there helping you. And then when I'm getting chills just thinking about it. Like, so this individual segment, I think, is probably the most emotionally best storytelling segment of all three games on the PS1. But when you get into the boss fight where Steiner helps you and you come into battle, so you start out and it's just Steiner and I think somebody else, I forget who. And then Zidane shows up and all Steiner says is, "You're late, bro." But it's like, we're bros, we're in this together. And then you beat that boss, and there's a couple more. And Zidane gets carried by his friends after how many hours he's been carrying his friends. And the whole thing switches. Like, I'm getting emotional thinking about it right now. But in the moment when I was playing it, I did have misty eyes. I think that particular moment was executed extremely well.
And the background track.
Amazing.
All of that is incredible.
Amazing. Yes.
It matches it perfectly. And it it feels like they tried to do that with Cloud when he like recovers from his amnesia.
Yes.
And 7.
But it doesn't hit the same
executed.
Way. Yeah.
This is executed so much better because it's the realization that through the game that he was there for everybody, just trying to lift everybody up, and then finally he lets everybody else in because he never did. And now he's like, he never viewed himself as like being someone who was needed. And now he realizes that he was the person who was needed, but he also needs them in return.
Yes.
And that is a beautiful plot point. That is, and the unfortunate thing is that it takes 3 discs
to get there. Yes. But it's hard to say, like, you couldn't make that particular moment as poignant and powerful without the buildup. Would it take 3 discs? I don't know. I mean, I'm not a master storyteller, but you couldn't do that an hour in, right? It just, you couldn't do it. So I would say that individual point is probably, as far as moving me emotionally out of all three games, the most emotional I got in any game by a long shot. In fact, Final Fantasy 7 and 8, I never got emotional ever. One particular ever.
And they tried.
They tried, but it just didn't land. So, you know, it's almost like I'm second guessing, you know, in this particular moment, I think Final Fantasy 9 really shines. I guess it's just the rest of the game that I didn't enjoy. And we'll get into the ability system and some of the side stuff and the optional bosses that really let me down. But I will say, as far as getting an emotional reaction out of me, Final Fantasy IX was the best. I think you're right in terms of the characters are the most endearing. We talked about other characters in 8 and 7. 8, they're all bland. 7, there's a mix of blandness, and we kind of disagreed on motivation. 7,
they're not bland. They're just terrible people.
8, I agree. Like, I like Steiner. I even like what's his name? Red? Not Red 13.
Amarant.
Amarant, where he has this weird complex about being tough and understanding. All of them. What's her face? Beatrix, you mentioned, even though she's not a total playbook, she kind of is. Vivi, I loved the most. Eco was probably the weakest for me. What do you think?
Yeah, she was more to be a setup character for Garnet slash Dagger, which is Dagger's fucking stupid name.
But, his dumbest name ever.
Like, actually, I think the weakest character in that game is Garnet. I think she's weaker than Blank, which is their little like trope companion.
Well, Blank has that whole that whole sacrificing self turning to stone. That got me a tiny like a twinge of emotional, not near as much as the Zidane leaning on his friends, but he sacrifices himself to save everybody and turns to stone.
I got to ask, you didn't get emotional at the Red 13 scene where he finally meets his father?
You know what? You're right. I did a little bit. Not near as much as the Zidane.
Yeah.
I don't think my eyes got actually misty, but I felt sort of the stirring in the chest, the heart. You know, I did. Actually, I fully did because, spoiler alert, with growing up Mormon and having some issues with my – I have some dad issues and not feeling super – I'm proud of my dad and I'm also not proud of my dad. Short story. So when Red 13 goes from thinking his dad is a piece of shit and then realizing that his dad is actually honorable and he's a great warrior, I'm glad you brought that up. I did feel emotional, so I take that back. Unless you bring up something I can't remember, that's the only moment I got emotional in Final Fantasy VII. But it wasn't as much. Like, I messaged you on Discord for that moment in Final Fantasy IX. Like, I just played this section with Zidane getting help from his friends, and I got emotional, and we both agreed, like, that's the best section of the game as far as storytelling.
That's the best moment emotionally. That's the best moment emotionally in the entire PS1 trilogy.
I would agree for the PS1 trilogy. I would agree. So, yes, when 13 finds out about his dad, that did give me some twinges and some feels. 8? Man, I can't think of anything in 8 that made me emotional. Nothing.
Because it's so dumb.
It is so dumb. Which sucks, because I defended that game for so many years, but I just have to admit I was wrong. The game sucks.
The saddest thing is you realize that Laguna can't go back to Rain.
True.
When she's dying.
Yes.
And at the end, when you see Laguna go to Rain's gravesite. When everything's done.
Yes.
That's
a little emotional. Probably
the most in that entire game.
Did you feel anything when Squall saves Rinoa in space? Like when she...
No.
You didn't feel anything?
Because they made it a stupid mini game.
I didn't feel anything. I'm just asking if you did, but I agree with you.
Why would you? Oh, like, could you imagine? Okay. I know we're talking about Final Fantasy IX. And we're going back to Final Fantasy VIII here, but could you imagine being that kid? I may have been that kid. They go into a catch the Rinoa mini game where you have to catch her in space. And if you don't catch her, she dies. So if you don't like her, I mean, you can let her go, but you can't do that because if you do that, then the game can't progress. You gotta catch her. So could you imagine like not being able to catch, and it's easy to, but could you imagine not being able to catch her like 10 times? And then like you finally get it. And then like they have this landing scene where she's like, I don't want to go back. I don't want to be a witch. Like, I don't care. I don't care.
Yeah. Nothing.
Like, I know you're going to come back in my party. I've invested too much into you. I don't dig the love story. It's forced. There is no. Final Fantasy is just bad storytelling. It's just bad. And we went over that.
Honestly, I felt more connection to Selphie. Because she's like this happy-go-lucky, innocent, just wants... She's like a better heart, and I don't know. She seemed like a little kid. I felt
bad for Kistis or Quistis or whatever. Because she's like throwing herself out there in the beginning of Disc 1.
She, and like she, right after... That's true.
She throws herself out there hard. Very hard. She's like, this is my last night as an instructor. And this guy's like,
okay. I forgot about that scene, which is so like inappropriate. Again, we were talking about children. And on top of that, you have a teacher who is essentially sexually throwing themselves at a student.
Yeah.
Which again is okay because this is 1990, whatever, and it's Japanese, whatever.
Yeah. Well, they're the same age.
Are they though? That,
like, she's a year older.
I need to look.
She's a year older than Squall.
I thought she was like 21.
No, she's only a year older than Squall. So the other thing is like, staying on Final Fantasy, going back to Final Fantasy VIII, how fucking stupid the plot is. But like, Kistis, whatever. She is like such a badass that she became an instructor only a year older than Squall. But like the way that she acts is like, she's like a little bitch. Like Squall is so much better than her, but it took Squall like what, like 3 years longer to be as good as Kistis? It's like, what the? Okay, whatever. And then like towards the middle of the game when they have like that amnesia bullshit thing, then Kistis is like, yeah, I thought I loved Squall, but I really don't. So I'm going to do whatever I can to hook him up to this random stranger girl. Like, oh my God. Oh my God.
God, I cannot wait to make clips of this podcast and post it. And just, because, yeah, I mean, it's going to do well because everyone and their dog hates 8. I mean, let's be honest. The general consensus is people fucking hate 8. I get it.
I hate it less, but I still hate it.
With 9, this is how I felt. Again, we're talking about plot. So I agree with you. The beginning of 9 is sort of general high fantasy. The only thing that interested me at the beginning of 9 was Vivi's arc. I do like how Vivi's arc has parallels with Zidane's arc at the end of the game. What I mentioned to you on Discord, and we didn't have a chance to talk about more in depth, is I felt like 9 kind of built all this stuff up, but not in a really good way. Then all of a sudden you meet Garland and he just like data dumps all this exposition that they didn't really build up to. And then he's like, blah, 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 different planet, taking over planets, swapping souls. And it all happens in like the last 2 hours of the game.
Yeah. It's another of those things that makes sense. It makes sense. But it's kind of like, it's not dumb. But it's like, why? It's not dumb, it's unnecessary. I think that's the best way I could put it. Because it's actually like pretty creative. But is it really important or necessary to what everything that happened before anything? No.
I would agree. I think the idea of like, okay, you have this different planet and a race of people who are highly advanced. Their civilization is dying. The nature of souls are that they're bound to the planet they were built on, and they recycle on the planet they're built on, which does have some similarities to Final Fantasy VII, reincarnation, Buddhism, which makes sense because this is coming from a Japanese perspective.
It's Sakaguchi.
It's Sakaguchi, right? And so they have to come, and then they have to prepare a planet, and they have to create all these clones. They have to use war to kill off all the native souls, and then they can like almost like transplant, like you're doing a heart transplant, but they can transplant the souls of this dying civilization into the clone bodies on this new planet, which all the old souls, because they need the planet. It's kind of falling apart if you're listening right now.
I think what do they explain? It makes a lot more sense than time compression. I'll say that.
It does make more sense than time compression. But at the end of the day, if you're listening and you never played this game, you're like, this doesn't make sense. It still is not fully – like I have a semi-clear idea of what was going on and what Garland's purpose was and what Dizane's purpose is and what Kuja, who is like a poor man's version of Sephiroth, which is like – I said he's the trans version of Sephiroth. You said he's the gay version of Sephiroth. Either way, he's wearing a thong. The dude wears the thong. And he's supposed to be scary.
He's very eccentric. Okay. He is very comfortable in his identity.
Obviously.
So leave Kuja alone. Okay. It doesn't matter
if he, it's he just, likes to wear a thong.
It's just hard to be scared of a big bat that's in a thong.
Yeah. It's a very Japanese thing, I think.
Yeah, and that might be a cultural disconnect. I do, like you said, I do think the general idea of, again, having another planet come and, like, transferring souls, that's all cool, but it doesn't really pick up, and we both agreed on this on Discord, all that sort of comes at the end in, like, a big waterfall of information, and that the whole game doesn't lead up to it and allude to it. It almost felt like out of left field for me when I was playing, like, oh, all of a sudden, okay, now I get it. And then again, the game's over.
That's why, I mean, I'm going to go back to what I said before. It's more of a character-driven story.
Agreed.
Than a, like, story-driven story.
Than a meta-plot story. Yeah.
It's about how the characters develop. It's about how they grow. It's about what they understand. The plot itself has elements to help along the character development, because without that information, Zidane not knowing his arc and his place in the world and everything like that is not as known. But you already become attached to the Zane, and it didn't need all that plot dump. And that's the thing. Like, I don't remember a lot of that plot dump. I mean, I played it a long time ago compared to you. I played it like fucking, I think 3 years ago now was when I played Final Fantasy IX. But even then, it's like, I remember the key plot points of Final Fantasy IX, and a lot of them weren't those exposition dumps. It wasn't the time they wanted to just tell you everything that was going on just to move the story forward. The things I remember from Final Fantasy IX were the times that the characters were having those great moments. Not the ones you have to interrupt the game in order to experience, by the way, because those are shit, and I think they suck.
The active time memories?
Yeah, like the things that they like completely stole from... Maybe they didn't steal it from Tales. I don't remember it. This could be there before Tales of, but this is something like has become a Tales of series hallmark. And it feels like they radically lifted from that. And it's like, why are you doing that? Because you're doing it. One, you're doing it wrong. Two, it sucks. Stop it. And it just becomes that, you have to do all of them because sometimes there's important plot points in there, especially in a game where your character development is so important. You're going to want to see all these scenes, and it just becomes fucking irritating. I fucking hated it. I hated that.
I don't disagree. So initially, I would argue that it went 8, 9, 7 with the PS1 trilogy. After replaying them, I went just in order, 7, 8, 9. I liked 9 the least out of all of them. But what I will say positive for 9 is I feel like the chocobo stuff for 9 is the least tedious. I enjoyed digging for treasure as a coach. Like, it wasn't near as tedious to me as breeding. And I don't even remember. What is the chocobo game for 8? I can't even remember.
Pocket stick. Oh, it sucks. That's what the chocobo game for 8 is. It fucking sucks. You like have to buy an item that you like get a chocobo whistle, and then you have to like guess where it is within a certain radius, and the chocobo lands, you get an item. And then you can put it on your pocket station.
Oh, yes.
And then you can play with it.
I totally forgot about that.
Yeah.
I forgot about the pocket station. Yeah, they built that whole thing around there pushing the pocket station, which is why I don't remember it, because this most recent playthrough, you don't need to do the chocobo.
They weren't pushing the pocket station, though.
Were they not initially?
No. In Japan, they were. It never came out in the United States.
I wonder if my memory, I have a false memory, because I swear I had one.
You may have imported it then.
I did import some stuff. I had a few Japanese games. Maybe I had a pocket station, or I might be conflating it with like another Tamagotchi type pocket item.
Possibly.
Yeah, man, I'd have to like go through my journals and stuff. Memory's a little, that's a long time ago, but either way, most recently when I played it, I didn't do any of the chocobo stuff. So for what I played with a strategy guide. So I'm assuming for 8, you don't need to do the chocobo stuff to get any items or spells or draws or summons, because I'm pretty sure I got everything. And the strategy guide never forced me to do chocobo stuff.
There's one chocobo thing I think you need to do, because I needed to do it for one of the items or summons. And it's like near the end. It's like the very end of the game. But like at coming of Ultimacia's castle end of the game.
Like, oh, the very, very end. Yeah.
Yes. That's the only time I had to go to the Chocobo minigame.
Okay.
In all Final Fantasy VIII.
So the Chocobo minigame seems to be, from both of our memories, less important. Now, for Final Fantasy IX and obviously VII, if you want to get Knights of the Round, you have to do the Chocobo stuff. You got to get a gold Chocobo.
You have to.
Also, there's a couple other materia. You have to get a Mount Chocobo for that one cave, et cetera, et cetera. For Final Fantasy IX, to even get to the area where you could fight Ozma, which is like the ruby weapon, the emerald weapon version in.
Which is not required.
It's not required at all. But for me, this optional side bosses are important because that's how you get rewarded for doing all the extra stuff and getting all the cool gears. You have a chance to actually beat the enemies that are harder than the main narrative final boss. Obviously, in my experience, Ruby Weapon and Emerald Weapon are the hardest by far. There's an Ultima Weapon in Final Fantasy VIII at the chapel. And then you also have another weapon in the sub area underwater, reactor, whatever it's called. They're not that hard. Not even close compared to Emerald and Ruby Weapon. Ozma, on the other chance, the floating ball of colors, the Pokemon ball, is a fucking goddamn nightmare out of all of them. Because
I challenged that?
I didn't do the there's a friendly creatures quest. That's how it was described in the strategy guide that I was using, and I skipped that because I just like, I looked at the items. I don't care about doing this again. I'm trying to play this game as fast as possible, get all the footage, make YouTube content. I got a life to live. I got a business. I got kids. I skipped all that. What I didn't realize is that Ozma is harder if you don't complete this side quest called Friendly Creatures or Friendly Pets.
You meet them in the overworld.
Yes. And that means that Ozma has stronger magic and he's also far away that even if you have long range ability equipped, you can't fucking hit him with regular attacks. So I went into this Ozma shit with the strategy guide, leveled up to the max because I had the speed boost, right? So grinding for me on 9 was pretty easy. I could put it at x8, auto battle, just put on a podcast, grind, get levels, get ability points. I mean, I don't know if I was fully level 99, but I was pretty high. And Ozma took me like 20 tries. I mean, I was – because his AI – this is another thing that people – if he will automatically counter you – unless you choose a command. Again, I would have not known any of this unless I was reading a strategy guide. I'm not smart enough to figure this out. But the way his AI script works is if you choose to say like, okay, Zidane, attack, Amaranth, do a spell, No Mercy, which is his probably best ability, and then like, I don't know, Dagger Summon. If you choose to do that action – not while he's in the middle of an attack animation, he will skip his ATB and he'll have the next turn. I shouldn't say he. I don't know if Ozma's a he or she. It's a fucking ball of energy. It's probably neither. It's an it. But even knowing that, so what you have to do is when you play it, you can't choose a command for your character. You have to wait for him to be in the middle of an attack animation. And then you try to fit all of your commands in because otherwise he will have an extra turn for every command that you input. And he has spells that can just wipe out your whole power. Anyway, even with the strategy guide, knowing all this, it still took me multiple times until I gave up and I used the booster, which means all the attacks equal 99999 because I gave up. And even with that cheat on the remastered version that comes on the Steam version, it still took me like another 5 times to beat him.
Holy shit.
So
there's a challenge.
It's a challenge. I did Ruby Weapon and Emerald Weapon, I would say, quote, legit, right? I didn't use any.
Yeah.
I mean, I used speed boosts throughout the game to make things faster and level up. But I didn't use any cheats for that specific fight. I had to use a cheat for Ozma. also super high level, had all the best shit following a strategy guide. And what's your reward? Like some goddamn crystal that teaches Dagger, her final summon, which I forgot, Arc, which you can get from other parts of the game. I was so angry. Like, why did I go through all this pain and suffering? You didn't give me shit.
I don't care.
You didn't give me shit.
Yo, here's the thing about me not caring about what everything you just said and your complaints. Because I don't do those. I don't do Ruby weapon. I don't do Emerald weapon. I don't do Ultima weapon. I think I did it in Final Fantasy VIII just because I wanted to get a summon or something. I think I did it.
You probably did it in seven because that's how you get Cloud's ultimate weapon. You have to beat one of the weapons to get his ultimate weapon.
No, you don't.
Ultimate weapon you get by beating ultimate weapon in seven. I guarantee you. I just played it.
Oh, ultimate weapon? Ultimate weapon's not...
He's not that hard. He's nothing compared to Ruby and Emerald. No. Nothing.
No. I don't. That's why I don't put him in that league.
Okay, I agree.
But, like, you look at the bosses in Final Fantasy VIII, like, I don't know, I didn't go after Omega Weapon or whatever it is there. It's like, why do I have to? And same with Final Fantasy IX. So if I don't go after the ultimate bosses, because I think they're optional for people who love the game. Like, you really love the game, and here's an additional challenge for you, go for it. And then I'm like, okay, you guys can have it. Have fun with that. I'm not that guy. Even if I love Final Fantasy, I'm not going to go out of my way to fight the ultimate, like, boss. I think, like, in Final Fantasy VI, I don't even know what boss it is. I've probably beaten it because it's not that hard.
Same with Final Fantasy IV. It's been so long since I've played VI. Are there even optional ultimate bosses?
Yes, but they're not hard. It's the dragons.
Okay.
The dragons you have to get in order to get Crusader, the Esper Crusader. And in Final Fantasy V, they have two. They have Shinryu and Omega. And they're assholes. So I've never beaten them. In terms of, like, the game itself, like, I can't judge a game off that. I can't base it off that, because that's only for the people who truly love
that's
the game.
True.
That's supposed to be their challenge.
That's true. And
so, like, if...
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. It's a small nitpick, and it is optional. I think my biggest gripe with 9 is the plot. And the art direction, because I'm not into playing a Pixar movie.
You know what? You're being too generous calling it a Pixar movie, because I fucking hate the design too. I think I said this on our episode. They're Muppets.
I agree. Okay, that's even better. Yes.
You know what? One of the movies I think is the most overrated of all time is Dark Crystal.
What?
I fucking hate Dark Crystal.
What?
Now you're shocked? Dude, the entire movie is Final Fantasy IX characters. Don't you fucking like sit there and be like, I hate the design. And then like, yeah, me too. I also hate Dark Crystal.
Okay,
like,
I don't understand. I watched Dark Crystal when I was six, okay? I thought it was a shit when I was six.
I'm sure you did, but guess what? That's Final Fantasy IX for me.
It's true.
I watch it, I'm like,
I can't
disagree. Like, I don't like this design. I don't like the design of Dark Crystal. I can tolerate the Muppets as kind of like this cheeky kind of comedy thing, like this puppet enterprise. But if you try to make it like a serious thing, like you do with Dark Crystal, I'm just like, no, I don't want anything to do with it. And guess what Final Fantasy IX does? It does that. That's what it fucking does. Especially when Zidane looks like a Muppet version of David Bowie. And it very much turns me off.
Oh my God, it's so true. He's a shitty David Bowie.
Muppet David Bowie.
Yeah.
The character design, and if it wasn't for the character design, I think like I would like 8 a lot more. Why? I don't even know why Steiner's wearing eyeshadow, by the way, because he is.
He does have hardcore eyeshadow.
Is he emo or is he trying to be a pretty boy? I don't know. Neither is, both are fine. But like, why? Like the entire character is just so bad. And it's almost like a mocker. It's like they're making fun of old Final Fantasy fans. Because by this point, like Tetsuya Nomura had designed Final Fantasy VII characters and Final Fantasy VIII characters. And I remember at the time, people were like, yeah, like, we don't like this Nomura stuff. We want to go back to when it, like, the Yoshitaka Amano designs from all the other previous Final Fantasies. And they're like, okay, fine. Square's like, okay, fine. We'll go back to Amano. And everyone's like, yes, finally we're getting it. And they're like, there's our interpretation in a 3D world about what Amano designs look like. They look like Muppets. Ha, ha, ha.
Oh, my God. This whole section is going to be the highlights for the post of this episode. Emo Steiner? Yeah. It's true. It's so true. David Bowie, Zidane, Emo Steiner, he does have eyeshadow. Not even just like slight eyeshadow. He has hardcore eyeshadow.
Look, he has so much hair, eyeshadow. Derek Carr from the Las Vegas Raiders is having, he's jealous. He's fucking jealous.
Which is too bad because we both agree that his arc is good.
It's great art. It's great art. But like the character design is such shit, man. And it feels like a mockery. In fact, like there's like the whole entire idea that this game is an homage to Final Fantasy is great because there is a lot of homage to old Final Fantasy fans prior to 7, which was kind of the idea. But like a lot of it feels like they're mocking you for not liking the direction they're going in. And I feel like the character designs are part of that. And that may have not been their intention, but that's how it came off to me. Whereas, oh, you don't like our new futuristic thing? Well, here's some, you liked it when you had super deformed characters on the Super Nintendo. Well, here's some characters that look like they were just deformed and you need to shut up and enjoy them. I'm like, I don't. They're like, well, then you're not a Final Fantasy fan. I'm like, you know what? Okay.
Yeah. Speaking of the homage, another thing that I felt the first time I played it as a kid and also the second time because I remember the promotional material. But leading up to this game, a lot of, you know, I had a subscription to, at the time, I don't know if it would have been, I had a subscription to EGM and PlayStation Magazine and GamePro and I think Nintendo Power. Like I was all in. I had multiple magazines coming in a month. I don't remember which specific ones had the promotional material that I'm referencing, but I remember specifically this is an homage to old Final Fantasy, as you said, pre-Final Fantasy VII. This is for the OG fans. And for me at the time, I had only gotten into Final Fantasy pre-7 in hindsight because my first RPG was Beyond the Beyond that I owned personally. And I had played 6 or 3 in hindsight since Final Fantasy VII came out. I think I had played Final Fantasy I since then with the strategy guide because the game's hard as shit. And I was excited for it. And, crystals. A big thing they talked about was crystals. The crystals are coming back. It's all about the crystals. Final Fantasy is about the crystals. The word crystal doesn't even come up to the final disc an hour before the end of the game. They just like shoehorned it in.
Even so, like Final Fantasy VI, which a lot of people who wanted to go back to the original Final Fantasies held up as one of, as the best Final Fantasy. And a lot of people, like when they say they're going back to that, I think they're talking more to the fans in Japan where it had been more successful for a while. And they were talking more about the nostalgia, probably for the Japanese crowd, not to us North Americans, you know, our dumb North Americans who didn't buy the games prior to the Final Fantasy VII. But like Final Fantasy VI was like amazing. And you want to know anything about crystals in Final Fantasy VI? Because I don't.
Yeah, it's not even there.
It's not there. Do you know anything about crystals? I meant, not, do you want to know? Like, do you know? Because like you could say that the material, the espers are crystals.
You but could it's not say like that.
The crystals prior to that.
Yeah.
So like people were fine without the crystal stuff. Or the element crystal stuff. Like they had crystals in Final Fantasy IV, but not really. Like it wasn't like it was in one. There were no crystals in Final Fantasy II, by the way. There are no fucking crystals there. None.
Final Fantasy II Japan or America?
Yeah, to Japan. No crystals in that one. In Final Fantasy IV, yeah, they're kind of important and you're chasing them in a way, but like it's secondary to the overall plot. And in Final Fantasy V, yeah, they're very important in V. But like, it's kind of alternates in their importance. They're like, oh, their crystals are returning for Final Fantasy IX. That's why I have a crystal here. Like, oh, good for fucking you. There's crystals. And you don't even do anything with crystals.
No, really. You just go to,
you can equip them and get new abilities.
Those aren't even like crystals in the sense of the plot and crystals being important. They're like gems. You go to the crystal world at the end where Kuja is hanging out to end all existence because he's an emo, angry, whatever. His motivation didn't fully land with me either, but we're getting into what we alluded to early. You beat Kuja, who is like a wannabe Sephiroth. He's got the gray, silver hair, long hair, but this time
he's better than Sephiroth. He actually has an arc.
He's not better than... Okay, what do you mean by better?
He's like more developed, and he's more than just an emo bitch.
Not even close. Sephiroth, I fully understand why he's angry. He thought he was one thing. He's this soldier for Shinra. He goes to the Shinra mansion, and he realizes that he's actually just an experiment by Hojo. He has an identity crisis. He learns that Genova is his, kind of his mother, obviously Lucia, Vincent's girlfriend. Or
look, I think Kuja's a better character.
How?
Like, he actually has a personality other than mommy. So yeah,
I feel like the opposite. I feel like Kuja had no character. He's just hates the world because reason.
Kuja has flaws, by the way. Kuja is like, we're going to take Sephiroth and Kefka, and we're going to combine them. He's like a greatest hits album that doesn't land. Like, I know all these songs, but like, you're missing a few hits. You know what I'm saying? Like, my favorite song isn't on here, even if you have most of them from like a band. That's Kuja. Because the problem with Kuja, I know we're going to get to like what you're saying with the final boss here. The problem with Kuja is that like whenever anything doesn't go his way, like whenever you foil his plot, he's like, oh yes, everything's going according to plan. So what you're saying is you set up something for me intentionally to defeat it, or for everything to go wrong for you seemingly, but that's going according to your plan. That's Kuja. That's Kuja. And that's kind of shitty storytelling, but at least Kuja is Kuja. And like, Kuja's not like the physical manifestation of some sort of stupid alien life form that everyone confuses between the two because the way the story is told is
that's a good point. I was thinking of Sephiroth. You know, Sephiroth the human has motivations that make sense to me, but as we mentioned earlier, you're not actually fighting Sephiroth. It's an alien entity. So that's a fair point. Kuja's motivations never made sense to me at the end, other than he was mad that Zidane was a better version of a clone than he was. And he wanted to end all existence because emo anger. Like, what was his motivation? You say he's more developed. You tell me, like, what was his motivation?
I don't remember.
That's my point. That's my point.
You're not wrong.
He just seemed like
he didn't resent Zidane as much as he resented Garland.
He resented Garland for sure. Way more. Yeah. But the reason he goes to the crystal, again, back to like the shoehorning a crystal in, is the crystal is like the genesis of all creation. And what I remember specifically is he's going to destroy the crystal and he's going to destroy all existence because reasons, because he's evil. That didn't fully land with me, but that leads.
I don't think that's a complete thing, but I don't remember. And that's, I mean, the key point is that if you don't remember your villain's motivation, are they really a great villain?
And you could go back to Seven, which I say would be a better villain. But again, I remember Sephiroth's motivation, but you're not actually fighting Sephiroth. So
yeah, they bleed it over too much.
Yeah.
It's because, yeah, whatever.
And again,
Genova's motivation is to destroy planets like Lavos is. Yes. That's why how you know you're fighting Genova, because it's, you know, Sephiroth's motivation was, I'm going to get revenge on everyone who lied to me, which is the entirety of humanity, because I'm descended from Genova. And so Genova's kind of using that as a host or a representative and be like, I am like, here's Sephiroth as myself presenting them. And because Sephiroth's dead. And I know a lot of people are like, well, no, it's not. Yeah, it was retconned. I get it. Congratulations. You're very smart. Whereas Kuja, I just don't remember. And is that because they were, I do attribute it to, I just didn't care about Kuja as a villain the entire game. I just didn't. I didn't like Kuja.
Yeah, I didn't. I mean, that's what it comes down to. Like, you know, I played it pretty recently before 7, so the second most recent. It's not too long ago. My memory's not the greatest. I don't remember. I remember messaging you on Discord complaining about Garland just spewing exposition all in the last couple hours. And we were talking about 9. And Kuja just,
yeah,
he felt like they wanted to make another Sephiroth, but they failed. That's what it felt like to me.
Yeah, they tried to make something unique with Kuja. It just didn't land. Like they were trying. Like, I think, like, the comparison from Zidane to Vivi was very effective.
That part was effective. And they tried. Yeah.
Sakaguchi tried to incorporate Kuja into that, and it just didn't work. It didn't work. At least for me. I'm not, and if there are people out there who are big fans of Final Fantasy IX, I am not one of them. I acknowledge Final Fantasy IX is what I think is a good Final Fantasy game, and I think it's the middle Final Fantasy game out of 3. But overall, like, I want someone to explain to me what if Kuja's a great villain, why are they a great villain? Why are they the best villain in Final Fantasy 9? And if Kuja is not a great villain, then who is a great villain in Final Fantasy 9?
It's definitely not, as far as I'm concerned, Necron, who just shows up at the end of the game.
Garbage. And you know what? People are like, well, that happened in Final Fantasy IV. No, it didn't. Like, what? I get it. Like, Zemus or Zeromus or whatever the fuck you want to call him shows up, like, very late. Very, very late in Final Fantasy IV. And they, you know, it's briefly explained, but there's like an hour or two in the time that they explain what Zemus is, and you have to fight Zemus. Or maybe even longer than that. I have to go back and play Final Fantasy IV for the exact sequence of events. But it's explained that, like, the reason that Golbez in Final Fantasy IV was doing all the shitty things that Golbez was doing is because he was under control of Zemus. And there is an exposition dump, but it's not nearly as long as anything you're going to get in Final Fantasy IX. So you understand that, yes, there is a villain on top of the villain that you've been fighting the entire game. And then they're like, kind of at the end of that, like, now you've defeated Zemus, or like, now I am Zeromus, but Zeromus is Zemus, so this guy, fine. Zemus just doesn't show up after you defeat Golbez and say, now I'm the big boss. That doesn't happen. Like, so when people try to defend it and be like, yeah, this is like just a callback to like the big bad just showing up at the end of the game. That didn't happen. That never happened. I like this rewriting of history from all these people whose first Final Fantasy was Final Fantasy VII, defending the honor of the original Final Fantasy games. That's pretty fucking rich. And it goes back to the point that we made at the beginning of this episode. Like, why do I hate Final Fantasy VII? And that's why. It's because people who played Final Fantasy VII, and that was their first RPG, then picked up Final Fantasy IX, and they were telling people like me that the reason that Necron just showed up out of nowhere was an homage to the Final Fantasy games prior to Final Fantasy VII to make us all feel good. It's pretty fucking obvious what your first Final Fantasy game was.
Oh my God, that was an amazing rant. Dude, I can't agree with you more, because I played 9 as a kid and almost forgot everything. It's forgettable. So when I played it again very recently, a lot of it was like, I don't remember most of this. I did not remember Necron just showing up. I was legitimately, genuinely surprised. Like, I beat Kuja. I thought that was the end. And all of a sudden it was like, oh, by the way, there's been no foreshadowing of this character. And I'm the big bad. And I'm just going to show up as the final boss fight. I'm the keeper of the end of time or creation or whatever.
So dumb. So bad.
It's like, I just sat there pressing, like, because by this time I had followed a strategy guide. I had beat Ozma. I'm fucking overpowered, right? Necron was child's play. I just like, I literally sat there like this in this position, hitting like my X button on attack, just thinking like, what just happened?
And by the way, I'd had a strategy guide, but I had not leveled to the point that you were. But Necron, I found easier than Kuja.
He's easier. He is easier. I would agree with that. I think I actually lost the Kuja once and had to restart and play again, even though I was over leveled. And again, I was playing super lazy. I had gotten the footage. You know, I had to like actually sit down and be like, okay, with Kuja, even though I'm over leveled, I'm going to have to make sure that I make the correct choices to get through this fight. And Necron, I didn't. I just hit X, auto attack, and whatever. I mean, it's going to be on my YouTube channel when I upload all the bosses. I just attacked him. And I was the whole time, again, playing through all of them, I was really disappointed in 9. I knew it was at the end of the game. And I was just sitting there like, this is the perfect negative cherry on top. I already don't like this game. It's already worse than I remember it. I totally forgot that you just tacked on this final boss with no foreshadowing, no connection to anything in the game at all. But it was like, oh, we need to just add an extra scene? We need to add
I didn't get it.
I don't get it.
It's a horrible decision.
I don't get it.
It's horrible. I will say this for Final Fantasy IX Defense, and I know you're probably going to disagree with me here. I do like the fact it went back to, one, a four-party system, battle system, and I do like the fact that every single character had unique abilities. So, like, your party composition mattered way more than it had in 7 or 8. And I think that says a lot. Now, the shitty thing is that battles take a year to load, and I don't like that. Now you're playing it modified. I understand it probably doesn't there. But like, if you're playing this on a old school PlayStation system, if you're playing the original game, every single time you get into a battle, it just takes forever. And like, I think that's really the biggest statement you can say about Final Fantasy IX. Is no matter how good it is, it just develops too slowly.
I would agree. The plot, like I said, I mean, we mentioned the plot. Like, the plot was okay with Vivi, but everything else is sort of just slowly brews with no direction. And then all of a sudden,
It's meandering.
Yeah. Right. Then all of a sudden, you meet Garland. They data dump on you all this exposition, and the game ends.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, okay.
It's phenomenal in between the time you meet Garland up at fucking Gaia or Terra or whatever and the end in terms of plot, but like how long it takes to get there.
Forever. Is, yeah.
It's just like the statement I've said about Final Fantasy IX is like, get to the fucking point. I say this about a lot of games that irritate me, that just drag shit out. Just for the sake of dragging shit out because they love to tell a story. Get to the fucking point. If you have a great point, you don't need to embellish it with flowery bullshit. Like, get to it. Tell me what's awesome about it. Because when it finally got there, it's like, you hit me hard. You made it great. Awesome. Could it have been as good without a lot of the stuff there? I don't know. Maybe.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of shit they could have cut out on the way there. They probably could have cut out a disc. But they could have gotten rid of the fucking card game. We didn't need that shit. The game, it's not Triple Triad, is it? No, it's not Triple Triad. That's Final Fantasy
VIII. Tetramaster. This brings up one thing. So Triple Triad is actually pretty fun on Final Fantasy VIII. Mm-hmm. I think the game makes sense. It doesn't have a lot of RNG. It felt like if I made correct decisions and I played my card rights, generally speaking, I would have better outcomes.
Yes.
And I played a little more Triple Triad because of, you know, getting spells and cutting down on draw time. I will admit that eventually I ended up turning on a mod when you draw a spell, it just gives you 99 of them. So you don't have to draw it 99 times. That's how I got through the game in like 12, 16 hours, whatever it was. But you didn't have to do that. You could use Triple Triad and cards and items, which I did before I turned this mod on. I like Triple Triad. Tetramaster, I did not play at all. Mainly because the strategy guide that I was following never told me that I needed to get any sort of special items. It just sort of said you could play it if you want, but it's like it doesn't matter. But there's a point, as you mentioned earlier, Tetramaster is optional, but good. There's a point in Final Fantasy IX where you have to play. Sorry, Triple Triad is optional. Tetramaster, there's a point in the game where you have to play it at the what's the town called where it's always nighttime in Treno. Yeah,
Treno.
You have to play
Treno or something like that.
You have to play Tetramaster, and you have to beat at least three of the four people. Sid, the Oglop, whatever regent guy, is the final. You can lose to him as the progress story. The previous three opponents you have to beat. I had not played a single Tetramaster game leading up to that. And that is the only part of the game that I got stuck on and that I was cursing the screen more so than any boss fight. I probably had to play, I was using save states, so I'd have to reload, but it was probably anywhere between 20 to 30 attempts to get through those three required matches to progress the story. Why? Yeah. Because I had done nothing. I didn't have any cards. The strategy guide I was following didn't tell me I needed to. And so I had shitty cards. I didn't understand the game. And then when I started playing it, I realized, and I checked on Reddit and other forums, Tetramaster is a lot more random and luck-based than Triple Triad. Mm. Not only do you have shitty cards, but you're really just kind of just rolling the dice if the game goes your way. And I found lots of Reddit threads where it's like, hey, I'm stuck at this point. I'm obviously not the only person that got stuck at this point. Many people got to that point without doing any cards. They had shitty cards. And all the Reddit threads said, just try over and over again until you get lucky. Which I think is bad game design. Like I get stuck at this gatekeeping point where I just have to get lucky to progress. And yeah, it is one of the most angry. I don't know if I messaged you, but I have a problem with getting angry at video games.
You didn't message me this time. You messaged me about a bunch of other games. Final Fantasy, not this time.
I just recently played God of War Ragnarok, and there's some pretty hard boss fights. But I know when I lose one of those boss fights, I know exactly what mistake I made. I know it's my fault, and I know what I need to fix because the game is well designed. With this Tetramaster shit, it was like, I just lost because luck, random, number generation. And now I've got to reload my save state and try this again over and over again. I don't give a one shit about this card game. I just want to play the game. I was screaming at my screen every profanity you could imagine. I swear I messaged you about this, but maybe it was somebody else. Out of all three games, that was the most frustrating moment. Was in Final Fantasy. And maybe that's why I ultimately feel like 9 I enjoyed the less, because it's weird. 9 had the most emotional moment with Zidane getting help from his friends. It also had the most frustrating moment for me.
It didn't have the most frustrating moment for me, because the most frustrating moment for me was going through that amnesia scene. That was painful on so many like levels from Final Fantasy VIII.
That's pretty close.
That's rough.
It's not frustrating for the same reason that you have to do it over and over again. It's frustrating because this is so stupid.
Yes. Yes. Like, I don't know. I never had a problem with the card game in 9. I guess it's just because I played the card game, like, up to that. I don't know why I did.
If you have any decent cards.
No, I had all the decent cards.
Then it should be easy. But if you completely ignored the card game, it's.
That's the thing. I didn't ignore it. So, like, I can't relate. Can't relate, but I guess if you never played it, it would kind of suck. And that's like, I'll still ping it, be like, it's mandatory. If you're going to make something optional, don't make something mandatory.
Yeah.
Just don't do it. Like, or at least have an option to get around
it. Or if you're going to, have an option, like where you do some extra work and you get around it. Or if it is going to be mandatory, then make some preliminary card battles mandatory. So I at least have some cards. Right.
Absolutely. 100%.
So anyway, all said and done, I still think I rank them 7, 8, 9 in chrono. Yeah. As far as, what do you rank them as?
798.
Pretty close.
And I, you know, the thing I've learned from playing all the PS1 Final Fantasies, and then like the pixel remasters came out, and I played through all of those, which means I played through all the NES Final Fantasies, which were kind of like really gimped versions in terms of difficulty. Then I played through all the SNES, you know, Final Fantasies again. And I'm realizing that potentially a lot of people hold up the PlayStation era of Final Fantasy as being the best. And I'm just like, it might be like my least favorite.
Ooh, I don't know if I would say, again, I don't have the same experience with the pre-PlayStation era. The only one that I've played to completion pre-PlayStation is Final Fantasy VI or American 3. Yeah. And American 2, whatever that is, with Cecil, the Dark Knight. Which, what is
it? Yeah, Final Fantasy 4.
4. Okay. So I beat 4, I beat 6. And I beat 1, kind of, with a friend.
Sure.
So that's all I have to go off of. So I have, it's interesting. 1, 4, and 6 is a trilogy for me personally. 3 games. And there's the 3 games on PS1. Overall, would I say the PS1 3 games that I played to completion are worse than the previous PS1 games that I played to completion, which is also 3 games? I will say Final Fantasy VI and Final Fantasy IV are pretty strong. Like, I thought Cecil's arc was awesome. Going to the moon at the end of the game was awesome. Six is great.
It's also like 25 hours.
I agree. Six has Kefka, which was like the best antagonist prior to Sephiroth. Many people would argue he's still better than Sephiroth. You have the whole, like, the world gets ended, Kefka kind of wins, and then you have to come back from that. Shadow is one of my favorite characters. So I don't know, but I also really enjoyed 7 and 8, and I didn't enjoy 9. So it's like, did I enjoy 7 and 8 more than I enjoyed 4 and 6? I'd have to think about that. What I would say is I would agree that many people think the PS1 era is the golden years. And I'm biased because I think the PS1 in general is a golden era of gaming. PS1 Saturn era for me is a big deal. But I wouldn't actually say, now that you brought it up, that the PS1 era of Final Fantasies is head and shoulders above the previous Final Fantasies, the 3 that I've played to completion. Because 6 and 4 are so good. It's like...
5, you need to play 5 too. Because 5.
I should play 5.
And Dragon Quest 5.
What's your favorite Final Fantasy?
4.
I can see that. My brother's favorite Final Fantasy is 4 and then 7.
Mine is 4 and then 10. And then it might be 6 or... Like, 5 is like rapidly rising, because in terms of just pure gameplay, it is bliss. But like, I keep looking at it as like the PlayStation ones, I guess, like, this is kind of like a closing thoughts section, right? This is kind of where we're at. The problem with the PlayStation era Final Fantasies is just kind of like a symptom of the era, where everything needed to be flashy and demonstrate how much they could do with their hardware. Every animation has to be drawn out. Everything has to be an example of how flashy something could be. But you look at like the Super Nintendo era, and it's still part of that era about how to be snappy and deliver more of a quick response to the player and make things very, very quick, and how it went through. And then you look at the next generation with like PS2, where, you know, you can swap through characters, organize them, and do everything you can with Final Fantasy X relatively quickly, even to the point of Final Fantasy XII, which is a game I do not like. It does not jive with me at all, but it's all automated. And even with Final Fantasy 15 or 13, you can just press one button the entire time. Very snappy, very quick. Final Fantasy 15 is an action RPG. I'm not including the MMOs here because they're MMOs.
And 16 is looking out to be like a Devil May Cry action game. That's what
Action game. But you go back to the PlayStation era, and the way battles unfold, because, I mean, they got a load, right? It's just the nature of the beast. Everything is just it's very slow. And the way the plot's told is just very, for all three of these games, I mean, Final Fantasy IX in particular, and Final Fantasy is just dumb, but it's just very slow. Everything about them is just very slow, and it's more about substance. How much substance can we give you? How much can we wow you? And it worked when it came out. It was very appropriate when it came out. But now here we are, 25 years plus away from the subject matter, and it's kind of like, well, 20 years plus. And it's kind of like, a lot of these decisions to slow down and make the animations very, very, you know, developed and fluid, and as a showpiece, it slows down things. And I'd rather play something faster. And that goes for everything. And that's why, like, I look at the PlayStation era, I'm just like, I don't know how I feel about this. Like, the further and further we get away with this, from this, like, this might be the worst era of Final Fantasy for as many people as that have held it up. I mean, the people can prefer it to the NES era, and I can understand why, because, like, programming, and I'd rather play the PlayStation games over the original NES versions of 1 through 3. I mean, the Pixar.
Yeah, if you're playing the newer version of Final Fantasy 1 or 2, then I would agree. Playing the original NES version is hard. It's rough.
They're pretty bad. But, like, I don't know, man. I don't know, man. Like, that was an era where it was all about showing how flashy you could be. And when you go back, you just want to play fast gameplay without modifications, and you just want it to be snappy. Like, the PlayStation era is just, it has not aged well.
I would agree. Like, at all. I even played it with modifications, with speed ups and skipping, and I still felt what you were feeling.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's a testament to the point that you're making. You know, it is obviously reduced by using speed boost and having save states and being able to speed the game up in certain points. I found myself, especially with Final Fantasy IX, because the plot just wasn't landing with me, I would play a lot of the cutscenes in like 4X and just kind of read and just like, just move on. I don't give a fuck, right? I just want to move on to the next spot. And maybe that's why I like 7 the most, where 7 I didn't speed through the cutscenes. Actually, I don't know why. I do think the plot at least landed with me more than 7. We discussed all of that ad nauseum. But your overall point, I would agree with. I personally like the direction that Final Fantasy is taking with the new one. I thought 15 is its own thing. But as far as speed and snappiness, it is an improvement. And it looks like 16 is essentially an action game. I mean, they have the director of Devil May Cry for the battle director. So it's essentially Devil May Cry, but Final Fantasy. And it looks like Devil May Cry when you see the footage that they've released. I'm okay with that. I have a hard time playing turn-based games right now without the modern speed boosts because I don't have the time.
No, I get that. But I just think maybe it shouldn't be Final Fantasy at that point. I don't know. I'm more of a traditionalist. I mean, I've said that as much here, but if you're going to make it Final Fantasy an action game, then it probably needs to stop. Make it a different series. There's no reason it needs to be Final Fantasy, because there's been no real congruency between any of the Final Fantasy games anyway. So the only reason you're doing it is for brand recognition. That's it at this point.
Well, if there's no congruency, then why does it have to? Why can't it be an action game?
Because in terms, I'm talking about more in terms of theming. There's like the only thing that really united Final Fantasy in terms of being Final Fantasy is just a familiarity in its battle system. And then even that got radically turned on its head with like Final Fantasy X. And that's why I maybe remember back in the day. I would
say 10 still feels old school.
Well, 10 moved away from the active time battle.
But it moves old school, like to just regular turn based. I would say 12. They adopted this kind of MMO thing.
11 was an MMO.
Yeah, 11 was an MMO. 12 was an MMO ish, and then 13, or I guess 13 versus turned into the 15. It ends up being just like,
like that's kind of my feeling on true. Final Fantasy. Like Final Fantasy hasn't been like Final Fantasy for a long time. It's just been a name that they was associated with the game that they wanted to be Final Fantasy. And that's fine. If you like, I mean, I'm not, I don't want to look any down on anybody who likes these games. I mean, we all like the games we like. And if you think that they're overall a great series, that's fine. But if you look at like the Dragon Quest series, it has an identity. And it, for better or worse, whether you love it or you hate it, Dragon Quest has played the same since it came out in fucking, what, 1986, 87? Like, all the basic fundamentals are there. It's still a Dragon Quest game. Like, there's a theming, there's a setting, there's an art direction, there's everything. It's like very, very congruent throughout the entire series. And that's not the same with Final Fantasy.
No.
And
yeah, it's true.
And I think that's why, like, people like me, just like, as big of a Final Fantasy fan I am, I'm turned off by a lot of it. And then I came to this realization. It wasn't, I didn't tell you this. It was another Discord channel. But like, when a lot of people say they like Final Fantasy, people like me, I'll say this. When a lot of people say they like Final Fantasy, people like me say they like Final Fantasy, what they really mean is they like Final Fantasy 6 and before.
Hmm.
That's what they mean.
Or they mean they like the PS1 era.
Or they like 10 and before.
Yes.
Right? Or 12 and before. But they don't like all of them. I remember when we did our Final Fantasy ranking, we had a discussion like, how do we say that Final Fantasy is one of the best series of all time when we sit here and we hate most of them?
We did have that realization kind of throughout, like, hey, we're ranking Final Fantasy, but we spent most of our time being angry about most of the games.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
What they really mean is like, yeah, we love Final Fantasy 4, 5, and 6. Now, that doesn't mean that like that's the only ones, because I know people love 7, 8, and 9. So I don't want to like sit here and just be like the cynical asshole and just be like, oh yeah, they suck. Now I get it. People love 7, 8, and 9, and they can probably sit here and they can tell me why 7, 8, and 9 are so much better than everything I'm saying right now. And everything I'm saying right now, of course, is from my own personal perspective and how I feel about these games. I think 10 is the objectively best Final Fantasy game. So I don't think it ended at 6. I think 10 is the best. I think it's like 100% objectively, if you're talking about your presentation, if you're talking about gameplay, if you're talking about thematic plot and how it jives with the rest of the series, it's objectively the best. It's not my favorite, but it's objectively the best one. And my favorite is 4.
Again, we've had this discussion. Like I said, I've defended 8 for years and I've shit on 10 for a decade.
Yeah.
And I'm probably 10 to 15 hours into 10 right now again. And as I mentioned before, I don't like, when I put aside the fact that I don't like the character designs, the game's good. So far, yeah. It's good. I mean, it just is.
But I think what a lot of people say when they look at the PS1 era, like you said, and they say it's the golden era of Final Fantasy or it's their favorite era of Final Fantasy. Like, I ask you to go back and I ask you to play it on the original PlayStation again. Don't play it with mods. Don't play with anything to compensate for those holes in your memory or the things you don't like about
That's a good point.
In your memory where you're telling yourself, like, I don't like this, I'm just going to erase it. No, actually go back and play it and then, like, objectively say, is it as good as what you say it is? They had a lot of problems. They had significant problems. It's not their fault because they did the best they could at that time. So, like, 100% say that. But when you compare it to every other effort, like, is the PS1 era really that much better than the SNES era? I don't think so. And you might, like, listener, you may think that that is the case. And I'm not going to dispute that with you. Like, I really want you to be happy with that. And maybe I am wrong. 100%. I'm going to say I'll take it on the chin. But, like, I don't know, man. I think there's a lot of rose-tinted glasses when it comes to the PS1 era of things because people just, when they go back, I don't think they're either looking at it critically or they are modifying it like you do. And I'm not knocking you. I'm just saying, like, this is the way you want to play the game. But they're modifying it to the point where they can overlook the parts that, you know, are inconvenient and to be in alignment with how they rank these
games. Well, to your point, there's a reason why the remasters of 7, 8, and 9, and even 10 and 12 have boosts. Like, in 9, the Steam version has a version where you can make it quicker to unlock abilities. There's in 8, You can, I mean, all of them have like a no battle option. If you just don't want random encounters and you just want to explore and not have to deal with random encounters, because random encounters are slow, loading times are slow. All of them have speed boosts. Why do all of them have speed boosts?
Because they're slow.
Because they're slow as fuck. To your point, right? So the fact that the modern re-releases of all these games have common elements, even in Final Fantasy XII, again, we disagree on Final Fantasy XII, but in Final Fantasy XII, one thing I hated is that you have to, like, you can get a new spear, but you can't equip it until you unlock the ability to equip that spear. It's just like an extra gatekeeper that makes no fucking sense. You could turn that off on the remaster and just have it be like a normal game. You buy a spear, you can equip it.
Yeah.
Why did they put that in there? Because enough people bitched and moaned about it that they put it in the remaster.
Yeah.
So to you, yeah, exactly. To your point, the original version of these games had serious flaws. And I would agree with you that even playing 7, 8, and 9 with mods and with quality of life improvements, I still had this sort of, okay, aside from my, I enjoyed all of them because of nostalgia. Number one, I'm just going to put that out there. I have nostalgia for all three.
Hell of a drug.
Right? Hell of a drug. That's what got me through all three of them. But if I take that nostalgia aside, all of them are pretty rough for different reasons. It just is what it is. I felt like 7 was the least rough, but at the same time, I have the most nostalgia for 7. And it's hard to separate that nostalgia, which is why I mentioned in the Discord, after I finish 10 and 12, I want to start playing some RPGs that I missed, that I never played. And it's going to be interesting to play them with no nostalgia clouding my impression, because I missed them originally. I want to play Terranigma. Everyone talks about the games, and it's awesome. The Soul Blazer trilogy is one of them. Grandia 2 is something I mentioned to you.
Don't play the HD remake, please.
What's so bad about it?
It crashes constantly.
The Breath of Fire.
There's a lot of other problems. Like, if we're on Grandia, like, they have some pre-rendered images that they didn't upscale. So they'll have a serious scene. It's, if you play it, if you do choose to play it, there's a scene near the end of the game that is supposed to be serious, and it literally had me almost in tears laughing.
Hmm.
About how ridiculous it looks.
So there's so many good JRPGs that, I mean, I'm a JRPG head, but I missed so many. And it's going to be interesting. What I want to do is go back and play other PS1 Saturn sort of era JRPGs.
Yeah.
And compare them to how I feel, because after playing 7, 8, and 9, I need to go back and play, but I'm thinking, like, man, I really had a good time playing Breath of Fire 3 and 4. I wonder if I played him again, would I like him more than 7, 8, 9? Because Final Fantasy is this, like, giant IP, right? It's the big dog in the space. But I'm almost questioning, does it deserve to be the big dog?
From that era?
Both in that era and in general. As PS1 days, like, I'm thinking about, like, I remember playing Valkyrie Profile and love. We've talked about Valkyrie Profile and the ending needed strategy guide. There's issues with Valkyrie Profile, right?
That's problems.
Breath of Fire 3 and 4 were a big deal for me. Xenogears was a big deal for me. But I'm wondering if I went back and had the time to play of all those games, would I like them more than 7, 8, 9? Would I still consider Final Fantasy as, like, the big dog for that era? Or would I change my mind?
I think, you know what? If I was going to go back to the PS2 era and you're telling me I have to pick an RPG, like a more traditional one, it would probably be one of the Suikoden games.
We're not going to disagree on that. I mean, Suikoden 2, no. 2 to me is the best. But
it has snappy gameplay.
It is snappy. You have auto battle.
Good plot.
You can bribe and escape. The plot is way more contained. It's not like the graphics, end of, yeah.
Graphics have held up because it's 2D.
It's weird how pixel art, you know what I've noticed about this? You don't need to mod 2D games.
No.
For modern times. Pixel art holds up. It holds up.
You don't need to modify the gameplay for 2D games either.
Yeah. Like there's a reason. Suikoden's a big game, right? It's got a cult classic. Why are there no mods for Suikoden 2? Because it doesn't fucking need it.
It doesn't need it. Doesn't need it. I like Suikoden 1 more, but like Suikoden 2 has a better, like more developed plot.
It definitely has more unique animations and more stuff. It's interesting that you say, for me, Suikoden 1 and 2 are almost one game.
Yeah, but they're not.
They're not. That's what I'm saying. For me, they're not. But for me, the way I view them is one cohesive experience.
Right.
And as far as my nostalgia goes, I view them as like one cohesive, one game. It's almost like I view Mass Effect as the whole trilogy.
No, I do too. No, I definitely do. Yes. I do with Mass Effect, 100%. Because you need one with the other. But like Suikoden 1 doesn't tie directly into 2.
Are you kidding me?
Not directly.
Like, not as play 2 without... Okay, I will agree, not as directly as Mass Effect. But
yeah,
it is more direct. Obviously, it's more directly than any 4 or Final Fantasy. They have no shared plot.
It's Suikoden 1 and 2 type way more.
Suikoden 1 and 2 exist in the same universe. They have characters that exist in both games, countries, regions. You know, they have some shared lore at the very least. But you are correct. Mass Effect 1, 2 and 3 really are one big game. Suikoden 2 1 and 2 less so. But it might just be my nostalgia, cuz for me a big deal was I spent all the time to get all 108 stars of Destiny in Suikoden 1, and having a lot of those characters overlap, like Flick and Victor, Pesmerga is in both of them. And there's probably more. There's 108. I can't remember them all. But the fact that you can get the main character from Suikoden 1 and Suikoden 2, if you've done the work and you transferred your save, and the fact that Suikoden 1 exists in a small – you don't get to explore the whole world in an airship. In Suikoden 1, the world's too big. You explore one little country and one little small local war that's happening. And Suikoden 2 happens in an adjacent country. And some of those people, it just felt more base in the sense of when you're playing Final Fantasy VII and you have an airship and you realize this entire planet has 7 towns for the whole planet. Right, the scale doesn't make sense. Whereas Suikoden gave you this sense of, now we're getting into why I love Suikoden. It's a total tangent, but Suikoden felt like an actual big world because the plot of Suikoden 1 and Suikoden 2 exists locally. You're not saving the entire planet. You're just dealing with a local geopolitical issue.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in that sense, you can kind of get in the Final Fantasy Tactics.
Which I have said on your podcast and many others is my favorite Final Fantasy.
Yeah, but that's PS1 era Final Fantasy, and even that like it's snappier. I mean, it still wants to do the substance thing where you select a spell and it wants to pause and do the spell, and then
especially with the summons, yeah,
it still feels faster than anything you're going to get in Final Fantasy 7, 8, or 9.
Correct, I would agree.
Like it's still a gameplay experience where if I'm going to play Final Fantasy Tactics today, I don't need a mod.
Yeah. And guess what? There's not that, there's like very few mods and they're superficial.
Yeah. Because like you can play it the original way and people aren't going to bitch. So like I think that's kind of what I was getting at when originally you're like, why don't you play the mods so you can enjoy them more? It's like, because I know what they are. I don't want to lie to myself. Like, I want to know everything that these games are so I know how to feel about them appropriately and how to like
but my question
talk
would
about
be,
them in the bigger picture.
If Square came out with a remaster of 8, let's say, another remaster, and they fixed all the problems you hate with it, would you play it or not?
I want it to be a different experience, or like how they did with the RE2 remake. Like, make it a new game.
Okay, that's fair. So you would say more than just a remaster.
Or else I feel like it's cheapened. I fully remake it. Like they want to with like Final Fantasy, like they did, like people wanted to with Final Fantasy VII. I don't think that just slapping a new coat of paint on it, making it so you can modify it all to all hell for an easier experience is necessarily make a game better. It just makes it so it makes the game easier
and you can bypass those things.
Well, it makes it more enjoyable in the sense of, like, our biggest issue with is a lot of these games are slow. If you can fix how slow it is and you're going to replay it, I would say, look, if you've already played the game raw status, the original, and what I mentioned on my TikToks and Reels and YouTube, here's a good way. If you're looking to replay Final Fantasy VII, the OG version, or 8 or 9, here's how you can replay it and get more enjoyment and fix a lot of the things that I don't like about it. Speed, slowness.
Yeah.
Why not do that?
Like, they instead of fundamentally changing how battles present themselves, they just kind of added a frame skip to it, right?
Yeah, in fact, Final Fantasy IX Memoria mod, you can say how many frames it takes to you can literally specify down to the single frame how many frames you want for the battle transition. Do you want it to be instant, or do you still want it to swirl and kind of have a transition? I set it to instant. Like, I don't want to fucking wait. Just put me into the battle. Right, but no. That's my personal preference.
It's kind of like just any, like in all Final Fantasies prior to 7, so 6 and below, you're bomb bomb, and then you get like the, immediately you're able to select attack. Like immediately.
Immediately, yeah.
Can't do that in 7 through, yeah. You can't do that in 7 through 9, because you need to like have this camera angle like, boom, boom, enemy, boom.
And then the camera angle swoop in.
Like you need a swoop or, why? Oh, it needs to load the character models. Okay, can we just have it so like everything is instantaneous, like it is in Final Fantasy 1 through 6, or specifically 4 through 6?
To give 10
like, that would be
credit,
cool.
I think this happened. I don't know if it's just the remaster version of 10 that I'm playing. I'm pretty sure this was with the original version, but you can set in the options the summons to be the short or the long version. Is that the original as well?
You can in 9, too. You can in 9.
I think you can in 9, correct.
You can in 9.
So they started to realize people don't want this sort of overshowy, let's show off thing towards the end of the PlayStation 1 era.
Yeah. Not making the showing off mandatory. The first time for every summon, you have to watch the entire summon.
Correct. Yes.
But every time after that first time, then you get an abridged version in Final Fantasy 9.
So they started to figure it out. Well, I mean, we've been on here for a while. It's 10:44.
Forever.
Yes. I'm going to edit this down. Your favorite Final Fantasy? Well, you said objectively you think 10 is the best. What is your personal favorite?
Yes. 4.
4, which is 2 for America.
Yes.
I agree. We could have a whole episode of that. My personal favorite is still Tactics. It would be interesting if I played Tactics again, if I still felt that way after playing 7, 8, and 9. I'm going to finish 10 and 12. I'll probably play 6 and 4 again, and then maybe Tactics, because those are all the ones I'm interested in. Although you are pushing 5, as I should try it. Maybe I will try it.
You need to try 5. You need to play it.
Other than that, I will have put this retroactively in the intro that I'll record later. But for those who are still listening at the end of the episode, who are you? Where can we find your podcast and all that stuff? Plug your shit.
All right. Hi, I'm Chris Copeland from the Retro Hangover Podcast. And you can find us at linktr.ee/retrohangover. What we are is we are a retro podcast where we and my partner Shane discuss a retro game or topic every 2 weeks. And every week in between, we discuss our top fives that are nominated by our Patreon. So if you stop by, you can either get a top 5 show or a game about a retro podcast where we just talk about it and then we determine whether or not it holds up today. If you like what you're listening to on Cade's podcast regularly, you like the chaos, you're not going to get as much chaos.
No.
But you will get something about retro gaming, which Cade likes to talk about in his history. So thank you very much, Cade, for having me on, and thank you for being part of our King of Games that's currently going on our show on Patreon. I really appreciate it.
I mentioned King of Games in the intro of my last episode that's actually live. I'll be mentioning it again on this next episode that I'm editing currently. As I've mentioned this many times when you've been on or someone else has been on, if you want a more professional structured look at retro gaming. There are a lot of places that are way better than me. Retro Hangover is one of them. I really like Still Loading Podcast. The Good and the Bad and the Backlog is another. There's lots of these guys that are really, really good, and they're just more professional and focused than I am when it comes to retro gaming. And I think Retro Hangover, your podcast, is one of those that's timeless, in the sense of when I feel like listening to your guys' podcast, I don't necessarily listen to the most recent one. I go to Spotify and I scroll and I think, what game do I want to like hear about? Because it doesn't matter if it's a year old or 2 years old. For me, it's about the game. And I think you guys do these segments called a brief history of, which I think would translate great as YouTube videos. If you just did like a 10-minute YouTube video where you had some footage overlaying the brief history, because I see people doing that on YouTube all the time and it crushes.
Very good video, probably.
You know, but all you got to do is go capture the footage, or at least capture the footage of someone else playing it and just give them credit. You guys have like the brief history is probably oftentimes my favorite, and then some you and Shane's back and forth depending on the game and how wild you. I like chaos, obviously. My podcast is chaos. Sometimes you guys do delve into a little bit of chaos, but you're much more professional. You guys have to promo your podcast. You guys are on a schedule. Every 2 weeks you can have a regular episode. In between you can have a Patreon. Whereas my podcast is, you get a new episode whenever you fucking get it. I don't know when it's going to come out. You guys
are get when you fucking like it.
Yeah. So Retro Hangover, I legitimately listen to them on a regular basis again. And I don't always just listen to the newest episode. I just, when I'm in the mood for a gaming podcast, I'm like, oh, I'm going to scroll through Retro Hangover's podcast until I see a game that I interest me. Whether it's 6 months old or a year old, it doesn't matter, because you guys have a very set format. I mean, I know you've mentioned your really, really old stuff is different, but I've never gone back that far. So as long as you don't go back to like 2014 or whatever the fuck it is, you're going to get like a highly curated experience where they have a brief history. They talk about, you know, I think you break it into like gameplay, graphics, story, all that stuff. And then,
We break down everything. You're doing a much better job of selling my podcast than I did.
It's good. I legitimately listen to it. The only podcasts that I probably listen to the most that I don't promo, because it's so hardcore, I think you might be the only other person that could be a good fit, is the Retro Amnesia, where they play a JRPG together and every week they talk about it. There's 75 episodes just for Xenogears. I mean, this is like as hardcore JRPG as it gets. It's just,
man, I know we talked about it before. If I had more time, we'd be doing that.
Yeah. So
I know we would have.
I enjoy Retro Amnesia, but you have to be the right person for that podcast.
Yes.
And I didn't even make it through the entire Xenogears thing. I skipped some episodes and went to the end because I just can't listen to, you know, 140 hours of just Xenogears. But those guys go hardcore. Retro Hangover is awesome. Again, Still Loading is awesome. Good, Bad, and Backlog. Adam, he's a badass. There's more that I'm probably forgetting. What's the other guy that we always talk about? Arnie. What's his podcast?
They're dead.
Yes. Those guys, there's so many. So if you want like more structured, professional retro gaming content, although I'll put all those things in the podcast description, Retro Hangover being number one. Shane is a badass. I think he should do voice acting. He's got a great voice.
Yeah,
beautiful, great, long, luscious hair. He's also a Dark Souls fanatic, which I'm a Dark Souls fanatic. So
yeah.
And you guys,
Shane also once had long, luscious hair.
I did. And thanks for bringing that up, you asshole. I'm trying. I'm close. I'm coming back.
It's coming back, baby.
It's coming back. But yeah, I should have never done that. But you guys also stream every Sunday, or is it every other Sunday, right?
Every Sunday.
Every Sunday. And you alternate 9 p.m. You alternate at between Twitch. You and Shane? Or is
it? Yes.
Okay.
We alternate.
So Shane, from my memory, I haven't tuned in every Sunday, but Shane is playing a lot of Souls-likes. He played Hell.
That was a long time ago.
Yeah. So, again. But and you're usually playing like ultra-retro games.
Yeah, yeah. I'm playing like at least like Super Nintendo or NES games.
Okay. I'll put all those bookable links in the description. Other than that, thank you guys for hanging to the very end.
Thank you.
And I'll check you guys later. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thanks, Kate.